know whether it's a Black Tuesday or it's a Green Tuesday, but we want to finish early and so that we can have a breathing space, so that we can go to the house very early, some of us. No, I don't know about the motion, but it's a Tuesday. Now, welcome to this committee meeting. I haven't seen some of the members because this is the first meeting I'm chairing this year. Unfortunately, last week I was not around. So, compliments of the season and of the year to those that I have not seen. One hopes that we will work well together. It's going to be a very fast-paced year in terms of programs and when we ask officials to come in short notice, they would have to do that because it's going to be a very short year as well. As you all know that after half of the year, we will be preparing for the elections and some of us will have to be out of this building to go down to the ground where the people have elected us to do the work. So if we call some of you early to come, you will then have to come and present everything. That's one of those years that is going to be very fast and we will work not like 2015, but now we will work like 2016. So those are the welcome words, and I'm hoping that the agenda has been circulated and everybody has got it in front of him. We are not going to change much. We will try and follow it as is. Just to make sure that everybody understands. The first item on the agenda is a briefing about the progress that has been made on the Constitutional Court judgment between the Estate Agent Access Court and the Auction Alliance. We're putting this item on the agenda because we wanted the Portfolio Committee to understand and be on the same page as what is happening. One of the reasons, and particularly the Parliament, needs to understand if we are all comfortable and happy with the progress made. One of the reasons for that is that the court judgment had given a deadline of the 26th of February, 2016. So we wanted to understand where are we. Today is the 1st of March, 2016. So we'll hand over to the department to give us a background and progress today and calm our fear and make us our nerves to be at rest. Can we do that? Thank you so much. I'm going to hand over to, I don't know who's going to start, but I'm going to hand over to the DG, and then the DG will then decide what's going to happen.
We prepared for all of the items. The accounting officer of the agency is here.
Good.
The CEO of the AAG is doing the details on this item. And I think it's also proper to acknowledge the chairperson of the AAG as well, who has joined us. She's looking nice.
How would it?
Chair, we will be joined later by Pascal Moulet. Pascal is joining us to assist us in the presentation of the Catalan project. As you know, we're going to be joining the efforts between ourselves and the HDA. But for now, Chair, without wasting much of the time, I'm going to ask Brian to lead us on the Russian Alliance.
Thank you so much. Brian Sheplock is the CEO of the EAP. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for giving us the opportunity to be here in this presentation. Chair, I'm going to start the portfolio committee surrounding a few opening remarks on the matter before we go into the detail of the presentation. Only for the benefit of the collective here, I would like to maybe just talk about who and what Ocean Alliance. Yeah? The Ocean Alliance was, during the Turkey Committee, the largest ocean union company with head office in the Western Cape. And the main focus of auction hearings was removal of property. So the relationship that gave them this extreme advantage is where they received instructions from the bank to sell commercial mainly on auction. Mostly those businesses were sold because the businesses were either in distress or they wanted to offload non-performing business assets. So they were targeted or actually used their position in the business world to actually sell those to the investor population. They unfortunately amassed such a big $6 billion turnover business, and we'll say that they got that business advantage because of systemic fraudulent activity, which is part of the business model. It's important to note that it became clear that for them to receive instructions from the bank, part of what is alleged is that the business practices were such that they would pay special in bank to possibly give the instructions to them to specifically sell those properties. They would also allege to receive information where the business person is in dire straits, in financial difficulty. They were already profiling that individual, and they would obviously be very ready offload that to the investor population. We are well aware that Ocean Hill receives a lot of commission based on those and the high value transactions. The other thing that's also important to note is that they also receive instructions from liquidators and would also allege that they would pay law firms and liquidation firms to give instructions to them to actually auction those buildings. So one might go and see that the allegation against them is twofold. The one is first, that they were involved in illicit transactions and money laundering, which is how they paid those bank officials alleged and lawyers in cash in brown envelopes for them to receive all the instructions. I think the second allegation against them was the business practice of systemic ghost bidding. And ghost bidding chair is an instance where you would be registered on the system and all the bidders would be on the pickup, identify themselves as we are the registered bidder, you identify ourselves, and then when you are start bidding for the specific property, then you don't know that you're bidding against yourself. So you're sitting in front and showing to someone at the back that is not there. And then, so what specifically happened in the Western Cape when Wendy Applebaum was buying a wine farm here called Coin Rock, she in front was actually betting against herself. So the allegation is that the ghost bidder, who's different to a vendor bidder, different to a proxy bidder, this ghost bidder is a person who's only there to drive up the price. It's not incorrect to be a proxy because you can be a proxy from the bank making sure that this repossessed asset is actually sold at the minimum price, and therefore you are representing the bank, but it's disclosed. You can also can be a vendor bidder where the business person who's buying non-debtors aren't used to go to represent themselves, same like a proxy. But what was very clear in this case is that when Applebaum took a photo of the attendance register, the name of this person wasn't there. And obviously the price should relate and so forth. So she asked, why this is part of our mandate is because the disposal of immovable property by a third party with a fee, which is Ocean Alliance, that working to finance what the state agent does. So Ocean Hills are a state agent, only to the extent that they dispose of immovable property in a disposal method called the Ocean Hills. And I think it's important to know for us that it is a win that we've been able to do two very important things here. We were able to stop a business who was perpetually defrauding Indians and South African property consumers by the economic practices and actually physically advancing the business model through ghost bidding and the other licensing schemes. Important to note is that in 2012, the way they were stopped was not because of the current legal action or past legal action, was actually because they did not submit a very important document, the audit report, to prove that the business accounts are in order. And if you do not do that as an If any of you feel that you are not allowed to give a new license, the legal case will still go on and those things will continue. But that's a very important tool that brings the security to the property consumer. That every estate agency must be subjected to an audit, he must submit such every single year, just like lawyers. And if he does not do that, he's not allowed to have a license. Thank you, Chair. So maybe those are the opening remarks in terms of the convention. So the portfolio committee asked us to update the committee on the legal matter if it also lies at EAB in terms of the constitutional matter to force. Sorry.
Honorable Chair, can you allow them to present? Then just note your questions, we will ask them at now. Continue, sir.
Thank you, Chair. What are the implications of this case to the EAB, but more importantly to the property consumer out there? And then what are the significant measures that will be undertaken to address the specific issue? We received a whistleblower report that there is systemic corruption within this organization. Those staff who physically work there. And finally, people indicated that they have been asked over the years to change the description on the accounting record to say that a paid bank official so much in cash. And a paid bank official so much in cash and lawyers in cash. Why this is important is whenever cash is being paid to any business person, you have to submit to the financial intelligence center a cash threshold report, any amount paid over, transaction like over 25,000 in the form of cash has to be reported. And the next thing is that any amount that you cannot find out where the auditors of those monies are coming from is deemed to be suspicious, and an accountable institution or a business must actually report such. So both the bank and estate agents are related to the Financial Intelligence Center and to corporate money laundering. You have to report every single transaction that is done in cash over the amount of 25,000. So the only staff made this information available to us. The second thing also happened that some of their competitors divulged certain information and some individuals went to the media, got lost, and talked about all the lawyers being bribed specifically on this case here. So we then obviously started investigating the specific instance. So we then undertook an inspection. And the inspection is where we duly appointed an inspector in terms of our legislation to physically do the inspection, which is the subject that we give authority through Section 32, Capital A of this Act. When they arrived, Ernest and Young, at the head office of Ocean Alliance within Cape Town, they were confronted with resistance, and they cited that we will not allow you to come in, we will not execute your inspection vows in terms of this Act, and they did not want to allow us to search and information which we have in terms of our power. And they cited that we have value the right of privacy. So just basis of that incorrect, because this is a prison president, we did not go to the house of the directors of the shareholder, went to a business that we've licensed to be able to operate. And they said we will go to the High Court to create the agency against us. Over and above that, they also then said that we would take the AAB to the constitutional court, and the case continued. But at that juncture, what the lawyers and legal people agreed is that all the information that we intended to search and seize will be placed in safe custody with an audit firm called KPMG. And that information is there. So that's important information that's been preserved. It is also true that fact which we have a relationship with also went and did a search and seizure with their own inspection powers, with TARS, with the Financial Intelligence Center, with all the other regulatory bodies. And they also searched certain information, made certain copies. I will say to this comment that information was placed in state custody with the lawyer of Ocean Alliance, which later was stolen and misappropriated and so forth. But the information that we seized was so safe. So the challenge of the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of Section 32, unfortunately, was ruled to be unconstitutional in this day and age. And the Constitutional Court gave us a means of how we can actually deal with search and seizure in the future. Where do I get a warrant? Because we do not require a warrant when we actually visit and inspect and certainly be able to identify. At the same time, the inspection power of the financial intelligence in the world also limited to say that you have to hand in a warrant before you physically go and inspect money on the necessary premises. Important that any action that happened before the unconstitutional ruling was given to us, it was only prospective for going forward. But all the negative done in the past is not at risk, and I can still keep it obviously comfort in terms of that. So we actually 4 months, and the important thing that we needed to do is they gave us the guidance going forward. You have to do warrant, the same warrant you're doing special for your following 4 months, and you have 24 months to change your legislation. You were right, these changes and proposals into your new legislation. It gave us an opportunity in the interim if we needed to execute, we had to do the following process. So that suspension of 24 months gave us an opportunity to work in the various aspects. I want to say that the financial intelligence center is the same golden part. The cloud also had a charge against their special chief powers at the legislative structure of support into the process. Which is the next level. So he told that we had up to the 26th of February to make the legislative check. And because there is no legislative amendment to cure the invalidity of section 32 and current form, we had to go and determine what is the remedies available to ourselves. The one is that from today or yesterday, the EAB doesn't have inspection power in the form it used to have where we can knock on your door and actually go and assess your compliance to the legislation, and then if we find in that inspection that you are not compliant, that we can actually take the evidence and cure that and use the challenge we have. So it's important to know that they gave us an option, and the property practitioner bill has been aligned with this ruling, so that the property practitioner bill is in new form. The Counter Act will be that constitutionally aligned document that will be curing the problem, and not curing the problem in the sense that we're going back to having search and seizure powers, but to tell us this is the process we can follow through that. Thank you. Our two options was, of course, if we had applied to the Constitutional Court to extend the invalidity of this section for another 6 months or period, we had an option to do that. The other option, the one that we took, was to actually make and try and get the legislative changes made. Well, the other option was to actually accept that in the New South Africa, such powers is overboard and they didn't get a warrant, which is reasonable, to the certain options that they had. So we are aware that the Constitutional Court has at most given 6 months extension if an instance must occur where you ask for such extension. And the question is to ask, would it be possible for us to get through the entire legal process to have this property petitioner's vote extended, proclaimed, all of those processes, and we thought it was unlikely. But then also said, as a principle, I think the Constitution is a high resolve before us, and we'd like to support the Constitution in all its elements. And if there are other avenues that we can enforce, why don't we use those enforcement powers to achieve the same consumer protection? And this is the approach that we've taken. So our option to ask for extension will not solve the problem, looks like. And then the second option is to just destroy the other enforcement powers that we have in the legislation. Next slide. Next slide then. Okay, so if we have to look at what are those other plans that we have. The Act allows us to rely on existing relationships. We can work with the auditor, which we've been doing all the years. Most of our reports, they call it reportable irregularity, comes from the audit profession. Every state agency must be subjected to an audit every year. If those trust accounts the deposit we're holding for rental deposit is not in balance, meaning we've got so many clients, this is how much deposit we must have. If it's not in balance, the auditor must report such a state agent to the UAB and to the independent regulatory board of auditors. We have trends and what the loss of steps, if they have been misappropriation of money, they can also go in and they can do what they need to do. So we also get, what about other compliance measures? So we have powers within the Act to do compliance monitoring, to do assessments, and we develop those further, which are other very less expensive enforcement tools that we could use, and we deploy those kind of strategies to physically ensure that the compliance with the legislation is made intact for the respective people. Thank you, Neville. That capacity is actually a cheaper model because obviously knocking on the doors has got several interrelated expenses. The Act itself empowers us to ask for information. With 30 days, we must provide us all the information. What is important is they do not provide the information to us. There is a sanction issued. That sanction could be withdrawal of the facility fund certificate, which is your license to trade, or which you give you a fine of up to 25,000 rand. And this is even our capability that we can increase, which is our desktop audit, it is very kind of modernized from the way that we have now, where we could actually ask for permission to do a self-assessment. Thank you, Chair. And these self-assessment tools, they augment compliance, they strengthen the capacity of our enforcement. When state agents submit information to us electronically, because of the capability of the IT, we can very quickly isolate all the various groups that are actually non-compliant. Because if the information is submitted manually, it's quite long to review, but when it's submitted to us online, we can quickly analyze it. Account balances are not in place, who's misappropriated money, and we can quickly respond to that. Thank you, Ms. Will. Once we analyze that, we can then decide, is this one to appoint a few writers? Our Act empowers to appoint a few writers, to take over their business, and to stop the state agent from proceeding or claiming people already guilty of misappropriating your funds. With those irregularities, we issue a charge sheet to them, and they have to respond within a specific period so we can actually know when the scope is very effective. Chair, I must say the memorandum of understanding that we have with the independent regulatory board of auditors has been a very useful tool for us. We've modernized the system of submission to audit, and as a government institution, I can say we can pride ourselves that we were the only institution that received the audit report online. When the auditor actually submits the audit report and he says someone has stolen money, it immediately automatically creates and generates a charge sheet. It gives a report to us and it can immediately appoint a curator. And that is very cost effective because it doesn't take any administrative time. So we have to increase our efficiency and our efficient power to remain really active with the integration of our insurance. So, question for us, we want to give the community comfort that the strength of the power we have in the region can be and this is not scared from our Act. It's still giving us enforcement ability in the other parts of the Act. We still can do the consumer protection that we're supposed to do. In fact, we will have a cheaper implementation model because we actually only use this in the rare cases that it needed to be done. I can also confirm that in the last 2 years, during the season while this thing was at risk, we never found an instance where we needed to actually research and seek information. And the leaders will help you. At the same time, auditors will tell us, even before we find it out at the entity, they will tell us what money is cost. Once we have the report, we immediately put the curator that's going to protect the consumer from losing money in terms of the conduct of an estate agent. We are receiving a lot of complaints from property consumers, and that also leads to DSOP, successful now, passing the information, restore subject to the disciplinary procedure, restore corporate to appear in front of the district and the disciplinary commitment, issue the various sanctions that it has available to itself, including withdrawing their license, and also giving them the various fines. So the other important relationship there, because the EAC was created in terms of financial intelligence center, it created us as a supervisory body for money, which we call it money laundering and terrorist financing. What we still are able to do, if we are unable to deal with the state agent in terms of our legislation, we also need the power that we receive from the financial intelligence center as a supervisory body to request and to enforce certain money laundering in the system. We must be aware that over the world, money laundering and terrorism financing happen through property. So it is possible that if a African market has risk is also there, therefore we need to have power in terms of financial terrorism to profile the issue and to put it in space to ensure that there's no money laundering happening for terrorism financing happening through property transactions. And therefore it's important for us to have those relationships with the financial intelligence center. If we find that the country we cannot reach, it's very easy for us to just activate it. I see we work with them all the time to get them together and they need to look at a specific issue that we, if we are not able to do that or something like this. An important thing that is a risk share that I would like to make the committee available if possible, that open lines can go to the media and say, well, we want this wrong. Because the intent of amendment wasn't made, so maybe now the substitution capital is stressed at the beginning that the EAB was individually used to act in the power of question two. The communication strategy that we have is that we will give comfort to property consumers out there, indicating that first is the constitution, we upheld it, we support the constitution. The second one is that all of the enforcement mechanisms which do have is still in place. In fact, the certain sheet is one of those tools that we don't use often, but we are implementing our assessment tools, our working tools, and the auditors. And not because you can be aware that when you're dealing with the public practitioner, the state agent that they are being subjected to audit, that they are enrolled in a continued professional development program, and those are issues that we would like to actually enforce to say to the government consumers out there that in fact all drug laws they are cheaper, more efficient means of actually dealing with enforcement. And that's why it's important for us to actually do that. We have created a multi-stakeholder group, which is a dialogue forum where all the representative bodies of real estate, from commercial to residential, to rental, to agriculture, all sit around the same table with us as the regulator, and then we are dealing with the ills of the industry, the good and the bad and the ugly. They're working with us. Obviously, very much on our topic now is the racism in the property industry, and working together to connect us to uproot racism in the property sector. So those communication strategies will be starting an agreement with independent newspapers, and they will be feeding over the human communication to actually show people what the power to do it next level. Yeah, sure. So I think that's where we are in the discussion with some companies in the community terms of the process. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chaklov, for that presentation. The important thing for us is to have that sense of understanding that the court has said by the 26th of March. The presentation is telling us that Section 32A is no longer in place, it's not longer working, but what the AAB has done is actually the property practitioner's deal is what is in process to actually incorporate everything else that is there, but Section 32A is no longer in process. that's the important thing that we wanted to hear. So, questions, clarities, committee members? Honorable Chole, Honorable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for presentation. Chairperson, when you were doing the PM, there was a lot of information which is not yet. If I can propose Chairperson, we can go to that information.
Okay, that information is the information that was in the public domain on TV, in newspapers, but now you want that information that they combine and give it to you. That will be that.
And then the other question is that on the slide, there's a slide that is not here. The one that is, under sister Eshebo.
Oh.
This is my screen, it's not here.
Okay.
And the last question is that one of, they have some option here, but I didn't hear what are the plans. I talk about the first option is that the first option we have very quickly here was to apply to Concord to have their invalidity of section 82A, second option was to have the invalidity expired and start putting in place conditions to make that in the age, like the person. What are the plans that was?
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Sir. I thought when I was doing the when I was opening, I was sent to do exactly what you are asking. That they are doing none of their parts because they have the process, the property practitioner is trying to accommodate all those processes. Thank you so much. Honorable Memezi.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think as a portfolio, we must appreciate that he has done what he has done. I think the department must give support to this entity. I think we are already feeling that it is representing the department well, because if as this government we are not really changing what is happening in the property market, our existence won't be assisting those that were excluded. I think this report does tell us at least there's an entity that is going there where we are not represented yet. So I think we must appreciate. Now my question would be, how fast can we ensure that this property practitioner's bill moves? Because sometimes it tends to remain in the department. Mm-hmm. If you can fasten the process from the department side, so that it quickly, we don't just think that the laws take years. It's not like what we want to see at the end. So we can actually skip the department from the cabinet side, because these things can be done quicker. If there's an agent. If there's an agent here, it must be done quicker. So from our side, we think if you, as a department, you fasten the site, you are ready to help you. I think we must appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Another person?
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I must appreciate the presentation, and especially the prelude to the presentation. It sort of opened quite a number of clarities. What I want to find out is, because this property or this property transactions and real estate racketeering is rife, it's not only the Western Cape. As you spread your net to the other provinces as well. Also, what is going to happen or what is happening to the other auctioneers who are doing the same thing right through the provinces? Also, there is the question of racism. How are you going to get into that? Because there are times when you find that people will not sell because, say, somebody is selling a house. They won't sell when they realize that it's a black person who's got an interest in it.
Mm.
And then they go and work their, you know, black magic behind the doors, and all of a sudden the prices are overinflated. Also, there is overinflation in the real estate business. I don't know how we can manage to stop that. If you could just help with that. Thank you.
Hey, we have a hip hop artist in the house. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Pam. Can we? I want to turn over to CEO to just respond to those questions and be comforted. Probably, if you can be able to tell us exactly the property practitioner's bill, where is it right now? And maybe just as you respond, just to let you know as well that the parliamentary lawyers are here. They are listening to your report. Because this is very, for them it's of interest. And so that they can be able to wind up their report on this issue. Because remember, they are following all the cases that have got to do with portfolio committees. So they are represented in this committee. So whatever you are saying, it will be good there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. So maybe to start with, I'm going to write up. I think the background and the context is important for the committee to understand. So they can always help us in the understanding of the community or the local border, because it's big business, like a big grant and names, but then inside there's rottenness that's giving the advantage and you're getting with that, because they are selling houses, even up to 3 hours, all auction there. We must really look at that in the community. So we will do a write up on terms of that. I think I'll check answer the option we have taken first, uphold the constitution and let's use the other enforcement power that we do have. And that's where it will be more work to build the plan. Other from amazing, I think the competition is below. I will have the department respond specifically to that. What I would like to ask is that the committee will report that there's one outstanding item that we integrated into the property practitioner report, and we are increasing the sanctions for racism. And I believe that this department and this ministry will be the first legislative solution to actually deal with racism in a very harsh manner. And we can use the traction we have in the property practitioner report and the use for the DG support for that to integrate those elements. So there's proper sanctions. Because we cannot continue with the tradition. Where people are specifically doing that in a specific area. I think our municipal advisors also subjected to a similar reason they can't use because it's black. We can't also disturb the surveillance of a specific place where you can stay. We've had yesterday at the Department of Justice event where I presented on racism in the sex of property that when you drive up on the Gopan with a very expensive car and you're specifically black, the price goes up. And it's been coming out when we are being used as black chips, they call us. We are the secret manager. And so the price are going up and up, and that's unethical. So if another person or another group is called, then the price is paid. But when you come to meet them in the field of a well-dressed profession of a black person, then the price is up. And those are hit artists, and those are things that we want to complain. So we can actually deal with those ones. We are national in our reach, and we do inspect nationally, and our other enforcement capabilities also deployed nationally, because wherever an estate agency is an important firm and providing us information about what we are seeing in all these provinces, and we are trying to reach and make that even more urgent. I think the system is going to be that thing that we will look for the province to really look at the participation of those both elements that we added, so it's a good time to get it through the process here. In terms of the progress, specifically where the police are going to allow advocates to be in, could you quickly respond on that to the
thank you very much. Just the last response, where is the bill? Property Practitioner's Bill. Can we locate it? That's all we want to hear.
Thank you, Chair. The Property Practitioner's Bill, where it is now, is still to be discussed within the department, but also to go to structures such as FOSAD before it can come to be discussed in Parliament. That's where we are, and we hope that in March we should discuss it and should pass it. That stage so that we can then make its way towards Parliament. That's where it is.
Thank you so much. So can we expect it to move slowly towards us by April? Is that what you are saying?
Yes, ma'am, but I'm hoping that in March we should be moving towards Parliament. So March, April.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes.
So the chair, maybe the underplaying the contribution of the department, it has gone to the federal advisor, which in time has come up and down, it's done all of that. It's gone to the left, the department push it through. It's gone to all of the committees, into the cabinet committee. Only the judgment that we are now adding, even to forfeit and to all the other parts, it will go very quickly because actually the only small change you can should be so it was really covered so many grounds, so I think we're in a very good place. And I think the department would be able to actually put it onto the agenda of this committee. And thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Neville, Cheney, I saw your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just to in concrete terms, the department is presently undertaking the socioeconomic impact study. Because in terms of the presidency, the deputy president who processed this, and we've got a process, they've requested it's a mandatory that all legislation before it comes to Parliament, you'll be aware. So we're undertaking that. The target is for us to present the bill to the Cabinet Committee on the 13th of April. That's the target date, and thereafter, the Cabinet to be introduced into Parliament.
Okay, so the speech of this bill is slowly slower now. It's no longer March to the committee. It will be just after the 13th of April.
Yes, correct. Oh. Because of the socioeconomic impact the study, which we want to just make sure because of the implications.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the AAP for that presentation. And we will move straight now to the next presentation, which is the progress that we would want to hear on the consolidation of the development finance institutions. You will remember, honorable members, in one of our first meetings when we started this term, we were told that one of the things that the department is doing is to consolidate DFI. And we were informed that the progress made, we did get a report on the progress sometime last year. We want to know how far are we. Can the department brief us quickly on that so that we are able to be on the same page and the same pace on this issue? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. Just to indicate, in terms of the delegated responsibility, the acting DG through the ministry has appointed myself as the chairperson of the steering committee which manages the consolidation. Chair, with me today to make this presentation is Mr. Moraba, the CEO for the NHFC. We've also got Mr. Jabu Pagazi from the Rural Housing Loan Fund. He's in front here. And then as well as Mr. Greta, who's the CEO of the NHFC. So, the consolidation is being undertaken as a collective together with them, and I'll just ask Samson to take us through the presentation and then we'll go through some of the points on that.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Committee Members. As never as alluded, that clearly a team that is involved in the translation of a 3 DFI into a single DFI under the leadership of the department. Madam Chair, you'll recall that you'll recall that what is desired in the Human Settlement Consolidated CFI is to the minister is a significant and an urgent implementation because it is a key policy developmental imperative. One is speaks about scale, which is size, that impact can be attained, but also to give human settlements the opportunity to later increase the private sector's participation in the delivery of sustainable human settlements. But also at the same time, even during the finance minister's speech, that there are a number of DFIs, I think, or state-owned entities in government, and some of those need to be consolidated to promote efficiency and effectiveness. But having said that, Madam Chair, there is also the human element side of this, and it has to do with the fact that there's a backlog of about 2 million households, if one were to take right from informal settlement right up to the affordable housing market. And even though we've delivered 4 million up to now, that backlog needs to be met. And I think part of the consolidated DFI is to make sure that the households themselves have a contribution to make in meeting the housing needs. Now, in terms of what is envisaged is that this CFI will be established via legislation. It has to be enabled just like ESCOM, just like BDSA, just like IBC and Land Bank, which are enabled by a legislation. So this one will be enabled by legislation. And at the moment, based on the option analysis that was done on this case, it will be a government business enterprise that will give it the flexibility to raise funding and also to retain surplus funds, which means every surplus that this entity makes, it will plow back into its mission. And lastly, is that it may not pay tax so that it can use that money to increase its developmental mandate. But it is the approach that we have adopted through the structures that the chairperson of the steering committee has alluded to within the steering committee. It's a three-phase approach. The first phase is the transaction, which I will just describe briefly, and then the consolidation, and then the optimization. Now, if we were to look at each one of those phases in terms of approach, the transaction, which is time frame-wise, is November 2015 up to, say, April. Now, in this regard, the activities that need to take place, first is to finalize the buy and sell transactions, which is what I'll come back to, and finalize the governance and executive management arrangement, transfer the payroll of both Nature and Vav to the NHFC, and provide some kind of guidelines in terms of IT staff and procurement and communicate that change to the market. That's the phase one of the transaction. Phase two, which starts from April this year to March 2017, it will address the change management issues and the implementation of the work streams that will actually participate in informing the integration that will be taking place during the course of that year, but also make sure that there's an enhanced business case that is completed during that year, and the legislation will be completed around about September 2015. The completion of the operational system integration will be around 30 September 2016, and then the strategic plan and budget will be tabled, the final APP in January 2017. Then phase three is what we call optimization. That's when this entity operates as a single entity from April 2017. It will be a full integration of all systems and processes and with new products and service lines. Now, having said that, Madam Chair, the legislation required is really the platform upon which this entity is going to be established. And so, in terms of resources that are allocated to the DFI consolidation, the DG has actually mentioned the fact that the responsibility has been delegated to the COO, who is chairing the steering committee. just to make sure that the role of the steering committee is really to oversee and give effect to the recommendations of the business case and to advise the minister in that regard. Madam Chair, the update that we would like to give, which are the decisions that took place from November until now, was that all two options were explored by the team. And the two options, one was to enable NHFC to effect the transaction through the NHFC, simply because both Nature and RALF are non-profit entities, and NHFC is a tax-paying entity. Now, for it to be able to effect the transaction, you needed some enablement. So that was one option. The other one was to look at the potential tax liability owing by RALF and Nature if they were to sell their assets and liabilities to the NHFC. And in terms of that, we realized that there was going to be a substantial amount of money of tax to be paid. So in view of that, we chose the option where NHFC needed to have been enabled so that it would be a tax-exempt entity and therefore it can receive the assets and the liabilities of Nature and RALF. Now, the third tax exemption, Madam Chair, was announced last Wednesday by the Minister of Finance in the enabled tax bill legislation. This will be now be capped during 2016. Now, phase one, which means the first transaction is that sell and buy transaction. Now, just to say to the committee, here the update about that is the following. Firstly, the issue of the state board of the entities, they have to be in place so that they sign off, especially for Nature and RALF, they have to sign off the sell part of the transaction and NHFC to sign off the buy part of the transaction. Up to now, an interim board structure has been recommended to minister and oversee the operational integration, which will take place during the course of April 2016 to March 2017. And to that extent, a project manager will be appointed who will manage and implement the plan on a day-to-day basis under the authority of the COO. Because the department is actually owns and leads the enabling legislation for the DFI. The way forward, what will take place during the month of March, will meet with National Treasury to codify the enablement to NHFC, and National Treasury is seeking legal opinion as to whether can they take this transaction to 1 April 2016. It means even though the bill may be passed later in the year, I think the opinion they are seeking for is can the transaction be said to happen at April 1st, 2016. That has a certain implication, especially in terms of the plan that we have, because according to the plan, from April 2016 to March 2017, during the time when the operational integration will be done, and at the same time, the console operational integration will be completed so that by 1st of April 2017, the entity operates as a single entity. Now, what needs to happen, Madam Chair, is that we finalize the sell and buy transactions, which board will sign off, and we commence with the other activities under phase one transaction. And at the same time, there will be a service provider which is GTEC, which is National Treasury, will be an agreement will be concluded with the department so that they could assist with the operational integration. May I just give over to the chair of the steering committee to add anything to the presentation?
Chair, I think just to indicate the reason we needed the tax amendment just was that if we didn't have that tax amendment from National Treasury and SARS, we would have had to pay what approximately 300 million. $50 million. So that was necessary. So in order to prevent that. Chair, just to indicate we're hoping that we can introduce the legislation if all goes well during the course of October 2016. because the process is we want to fast track that so that, that as the time frame is given by the chair. So I just want to ask, I'm not sure if Beware or Jabu, if you want to indicate or add anything. So I thought we must just present so that we have representation and the portfolio is aware that the CEO is together with the boards of all three entities on board, and there's full support behind the minister and the department in relation to this. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. So work is in progress. Everything will be done and dusted, including the legislation, by April 2017. And you are hoping to pass to legislation, to conclude the legislation by October, that it comes before us by October 2016. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you so much. There's a report, Honorable Members, Honorable Ghana, Honorable Tone, Honorable Papa, Honorable Macau.
Thank you very much, and greetings, fellow members and the department. I just want to make sure that I heard correctly. You are saying after the buying and selling, it effectively means that the board of both Nature and Ralph disband, and then also the NHFC, which will lead to the interim board. Which will open in between now and 2017. Once again, whether I had correctly. And the other thing that I did not hear, Chair, while it's a buy and sell, you know, with any acquisitions and measures, one of the things that do happen is that people do tend to lose their jobs, you know. And one of the things that I'm not sure whether it's factored that in or it's assumed that every employee of Nature and RAS will now find space in NHFC, because NHFC is the one that's doing the buying. So first is that these two entities will collapse into NHFC or get settled by NHFC. Is to check from the staff side, the employee side, is everyone going to be absorbed into the new unit, or people are going to lose their jobs as a result. And the last one is it's not clear there. With moves like this, obviously it does cost something. That's why you went to get an exemption to save that 70 million. But surely there are sums of money that is costing the department or anything. I don't know who's paying for this. I just want to check what is the cost of this entire move to the department, and who's going to actually put the bill for the cost. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Chair.
No, Chair, I'm too covered. My cousin was on staff.
Thank you, Honorable Sterling. Honorable Macau.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just need clarity on two points. The presenter spoke about the participation of private sector in terms of assisting to clear the backlog on human settlement. I just need to check if there's any positive response with regard to that from the side of the private sector. And you spoke also about backlog of 2 million households. I just need clarity, how far are we as a country in terms of trying to work on that? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Papa.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, to Honorable Ghana, touched very because what I was coming to say. But I was going to come broader on it. Not only, in fact, I wanted to say the presenter has information which might be taken for granted that we know about this, that there is the involvement of other stakeholders, unions, and the other board members, the
already consensus somewhere, and I'm definitely sure that no union would agree to this process if there are indications and signs that their members will do so. But now we need to be enlightened about that, how far this is. And also, to make us comfortable on the reduced cost that is going to be that is going to have an implication on this consolidation, because I know for some time it was not going on, and now with that involvement and all the stakeholders, all the stakeholders involved, and also the comfort also that we know we are comfortable that all boards, all decisions are here, so that we are probably consolidated. But to also get comfort that we don't get anything later, that another board was feeling that they are marginalized, they don't get this, or there may be bargaining decisions that at least in this new board, if we get this and that and so on. But all those will assist us to have comfort that this consolidation is giving us exactly what we want and what the minister has been expecting to get over the years. And also, this human element, this human factor of the compass is one also we should be clarified, so that there should be no mitigation in the future and something that we didn't know in the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. As you respond, I just wanted clarity because you talk about RALF, NHFC and NATURE in terms of this process. But if my memory serves me well, is that some of the functions of SHRA are going to fall onto this body once this is used. So I just wanted to know how SHRA is being taken on board in terms of this process as well, as you respond. Thank you so much. Honorable Nakakabash, and then you will respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. The three items that I wanted to raise, to emphasize that was the question of that we at least we have the board that is chaired by a neutral person from among the entities, which is the department that takes care of having a principal entity among other entities. That is very important to us. The second point also was really and the job losses. We don't want to see any job losses at this period in our country, and that must be really taken. Not a single soul must go hungry because of due to the restructuring or the consolidation. And then the third part was also about the chair. So the chair has covered that, and there's just an emphasis from our side. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the crucial issue is that in relation to the commitment around job security in relation to the three entities, as the department together with the ministry, we've indicated that this program should and must not lead to any job loss. So the job security in relation to all the employees of all three entities is guaranteed. The point being, Chair, this is not a rationalization or a restructuring exercise. It's a consolidation exercise. It is about a bigger, better, efficient, effective, consolidated entity. Because at the end of the day, what we want to be able to do, as I think Mr. Monaba has indicated, is an entity, a DFI, that is able to meet its obligations or assist the department and government to meet its obligations, particularly in relation to financing. So I think that's been clear, and from where we sit, that is the instruction that we've given from the department to the three entities. The second point, Chair, is that in relation to the boards, ministers written and all three boards, in terms of their chairperson, have been informed. In fact, Chair, as a backup to that, we have briefed from the department on behalf with the mandate of the minister. We briefed him on the expectations. I
think from where I sit, and I think that can be confirmed by the three CEOs who represent their board here today, that there is full and total support of this because of the big picture, and I think you've indicated that. Chair, the third issue in relation to the boards is that there will be a reconstituted board of the NHSC post the buy and sell. So each of the Rao Nurture, as together with the NHSC, will then propose to minister names, and then minister will then reconstitute that board. So it's important to note that pending this exercise, there will be a couple of things that will run parallel. So in closing of this and making sure that we comply with the legislation and procedural requirements, the business of Nurture, the business of Ralph will be closed in terms of the finances and the annual financial statements. So those boards will remain in place, so they decide you should be responsibility are taken care of. Chair, the cost of this is being covered by the department and the preliminary cost that we've got, particularly in relation to the last point, which is the GTAC, that amount the amount that will cost is 7 million. So that's in relation to the various work streams, the legislation, the integration, and whatever needs to happen. So the amount that we have, which we've been costed as part of the GTAC process for the service provider and the various work streams, is 7 million. The project is being managed internally with the PCOs and the acting GG as the custodian on behalf of the minister, together with advisors delegated to assist in this process. Yes, you're correct, Chair. The SHRA investment function will form part of the consolidated entity. And there is a policy document, Chair, which we can make available, which forms the basis of this. It's also important to note that this consolidation of the DFIs also finds place within the white paper. So there's consistency between the white paper, what we're doing in terms of a policy, in terms of what we're doing as a legislative process. Chair, I'll just ask Mr. Morava and perhaps the other two CEOs to comment on this.
Chair, I think in the first instance, right, I'm delighted to hear the concerns of the committee, particularly as it relates to the human aspect of it. Now, as part of that, the change management process that will take place will be done right very early so that it affects everyone. Obviously, in a state of flux, people get disturbed, not knowing the way their future is going to end up. And therefore, that needs to be addressed upfront, and it's something that we have brought forward to make sure it becomes a process that underpins everything else that we do. But however, I'd like to also to give comfort to the committee that it's not about a win for any institution. This is about human settlement. We'd like to establish within human settlement exactly what land bank is to agriculture, what DBSA is to infrastructure. Now, every time you read in the newspapers, either the Minister of Finance or government is putting a guarantee behind DBSA, behind IDC, behind land bank to do certain things in the country. Now, human settlement has been left behind simply because we've been doing it in recent pieces, and therefore part of the consolidation is really to muscle up the capacity and the capability of human settlement so that we can become a force that can actually deal with the backlog. Now, I said 4 million we've delivered up to now, but that's not enough. We still have a backlog of 2 million. And to that extent, we can't do it alone. We need to do that in partnership with the private sector. Now, just to answer the question, the minister has established an agreement with the banking sector. What we need now is a number of tools that will incentivize and at the same time penalize that kind of participation to make sure that it takes place. And it's not always easy to bring the private sector, but we're going to be putting forward some option for them, because we've got the muscles and we've got the capability and the flexibility for us to be able to do so. So I think at the end of it all, it should be human settlement that wins in terms of its approach, in terms of its way of doing things, I think, going forward. By consolidating the whole funding and financing strategy, it should make it easier for it as a lever to have greater impact than what we have up to now. Nevertheless, address the issue of board. Well, the union, let me say, issue of staff, I think it's been taken care of. And so at the moment, we don't envisage that to be a factor. And no institution, as I said, will be marginalized in the process. This is not about the institution. It's about the strategic intent of why we're doing this. In fact, what the minister said is the three together must, when they've come together as a single entity, it should be more than the individual entity. So at the end of the day, it is the strategic rationale of human settlement that will be driving every work that will be done in this regard. I think if I may ask my colleague, maybe Viewer or Somlani, maybe in the viewer.
Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. Just to add to the colleagues what they have outlined, there's a question on whether there are any anticipated hurdles placed on the part of the board members. I just want to add that that's the most complex structure, in nature, where there was the Soros Economic Development Foundation as a member of nature. They have signed the consent for consolidation and to exit, and we've paid all the dues, and what is remaining right now is the AGM that will formalize their exit in nature. So they have been supportive of the consolidation all along. Secondly, just to add on the job authority, I think we also need to note that whilst these three entities are consolidating, there are product streams that we have been fulfilling as these three entities, and there are no major overlaps in the streams, and therefore there's content that will keep the staff busy in terms of fulfilling the work of the entity. So it does not necessarily mean that there will be inefficiency. People will be fully absorbed in fulfilling the work, particularly at stage two consolidation as we go through the increased processes. Thirdly, there was a question around private sector participation. And I must just say, all the three entities have got a history of collaboration with the private sector and gearing private sector to participate. So when you look at all the three annual reports throughout the history of the institution, they have leveraged the private sector participation. And what we're seeking to do is to then leverage and have a bigger balance sheet that will leverage more participation of the private sector in the human settlement area. So we come with those expertise in consolidated institution. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I will not repeat what my colleagues have said, but I just want to confirm that from the website, the board is fully behind this process. It has expert reviews and made comments on the draft agreement, the buyer-seller agreement. So the only thing that the board is now waiting for is finalization for the consideration or the basis of the consultation. So once the draft agreement is concluded, then the board will be ready to take a resolution to support its consultation. And then on the issue of job losses, I mean, as well, you know that we have had very, very dean staff focusing on rural areas only. But with the consultation, the focus of the implemented housing finance product will be nationally, including urban areas. So from where we are sitting, we don't see a prospect of job losses, but in fact, we see a prospect of creating the more jobs if we were to implement the project that we are currently implementing at the 5K.
Thank you so much. From our side, we will be monitoring the process very closely, and we will be calling you now and again Mr. Chen is to update us on this process. Thank you so much. I think without any waste of time, we proceed if there's no other additions on this issue. And we are proceeding to the third item on the agenda, which is the progress report on the catalyst project.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission and committee, I'll ask Mr. Pascal Molloy, the CEO for the HDA, which has been in conjunction with the department managing the process of the rollout of the catalyst project.
You can take a body break of 2 minutes while they are putting themselves up. Open that door just for one moment, and then we can start. But please don't go out because we are going to start just now.
Media
identified during the course of the presentation. And we're here to report progress against that process and also to give you a sense of where we are towards achieving that medium-term target. We'll take you through 7 points. There'll be the mandate looking at how it fits with our national priorities and programs, and specifically how it fits with the National Development Plan, how the projects are defined. We look at a certain number of areas of benefits for both the private sector and the public sector. We'll then take you through the process that we followed to get to a point where we arrive at the recommendations that we're making to the minister. And then talk a bit about funding arrangements, the way forward, the next steps that we anticipate going forward, and a few sets of recommendations. Well, I think the first thing to outline is to be very clear about what program we're trying to address. We don't just go into a program and a set of projects without defining what type of what problem is. So we have a very brief problem statement, which is probably known to most of you around the room. That our human settlement presence remains still dysfunctional after a couple, so many years of our democracy across the country. That we have a fractured housing market with inequitable access to working families benefits. We have ongoing property affordability challenges. We have very weak partial planning and governance capabilities, both especially within the public sector, but also some of it is reflected in the way the private sector also operates. We have inadequacies in our own provision of our housing and human settlement standards, and our numbers, I'm sure, as you've been realizing, have been going down over time. So that's the problem statement. We hope that through these catalytic projects we'll be addressing that those types of problems. So what are catalytic projects? We define them in a couple of terms. One, we're talking about scale, anything above 10,000 units or more, 5,000, 10,000 units or more. Other people prefer to call them mega projects. If you talk to the province of Gauteng, they have mega cities. When you talk to other people, they have mega projects defined in different ways. We're talking about mega in terms of scale, and we're giving ourselves a target of over 10,000 units. But it's not only scale that counts. There's also a matter of impact, that there could be areas where there might not be, we might not be looking at that number of units of delivery top structures and other amenities, but they might be located so strategically that they're going to make a high difference in terms of changing the lives of our people and ensuring that the decent standard of living even in areas where the impact might be small. Mostly maybe you could think about inner cities, you can think about areas that are strategically located in some of our very urban areas that might require some intervention or the other. But the underlying principle is that these will be specially targeted interventions, and how we target those we'll outline in a couple of slides. But they will be targeted, will be deliberate, we'll be seeking certain outcomes. It's not just any area that we're talking about in the country. We have to be very deliberate. We have trade-offs. There are certain things that we have to offset for us to make those projects work. And the main intention is that we measure, if we say we've succeeded in delivering those catalytic projects 15 years from now, that would be the last line there. We'll have to be able to ask ourselves whether they have succeeded in restructuring our settlement patterns. Have we crossed the apartheid special bridge, and then have we made an impact also on our environment? So that's the definition. I thought maybe I should dwell a bit more on that because it will keep on coming up. Like I said, the mandate comes from the MTSF via a mandate also that's articulated by the minister, and she's been articulating this mandate in a number of platforms, including from the budget speech, which she made on the 15th of July in 2014, and I've already made a point about the national
since the National Assembly in Catholic Church.
There are a number of development objectives. I might have covered some of them already, but they are about supporting development of functionally and ethically residential property markets. They are about looking at delivering mega or high impact integrated and sustainable human settlements. We want to be able, through these projects, to increase the provision of housing opportunities. And at the end of the day, we want to see better living environmental conditions and improving institutional capacity coordination between different spheres of government, between municipalities and provinces, between ourselves and provinces, and within provinces themselves, or within horizontal across departments. Better coordination between human settlements and water, electricity, and roads, etc. When you go into those projects, you should also be learning to work together collectively as others of the state and government. Now, this is a very important linkage. We developed a spatial master plan. I'm sure that has been shared with this committee in the past. It's a map of the country that looks at a number of factors, economic factors, looks at a number of national programs that have been done by the state, from your infrastructure programs, your corridors, your mining towns, our own NAFTA areas, your priority, seven the cities, 12 of them. So we took all that and put them together and put a number of common denominators that would say to anyone in the room and outside the room that if you're talking about where the sustainable human settlements should be located in the country, that would be mapped on the master spatial plan. So we use that master spatial plan to direct the projects and the recommendations and the submissions that we're getting from government and the private sector, but we also use that to define where the necessary infrastructure and amenities must go in the country. And those are some of the key elements that we consider. That one, the spatial plan should be a guide for government and investment. It creates a single national project pipeline, or it guides a single national project pipeline. But it's also used as a call for all stakeholders, both within government and outside government, to collaborate and coordinate their operations. So it doesn't matter whether in the private sector or in government, on the basis of the master spatial plan, we also hope that it will guide where private sector makes its own investments as well. They still are involved in the human settlements, private sector, especially bonded commercial properties, but we'd like them to locate them within the spatial framework that they have developed. So to make it much more graphic, that we want to move from a human settlement special master plan and use that to select catalytic projects, use that to guide special investments where the money and the resources should be going, and take a 15-year horizon in terms of our pipeline. Most of the projects that we'll be talking about are not short-term projects. They are about, like I said, between 5 and 15 years. So they will go beyond our political terms and MGF period, and would probably yield results around 2015. And ultimately would have those areas being reflected as special transformation in our special transformation plan. The NDP, I won't dwell much into that, but it sets two horizons. On the one hand, there's a 2050 ambition, which seeks to see South Africa fully transformed in a particular way. By 2055, I think, as you realize some of the provinces or some of the municipalities, they've taken a 2055 horizon of how the plan should be. Our own national development plan talks about specific things that need to happen by 2030, including looking at breaking apart the special patents. For those of you who have the NDP, you probably want to refer to Chapter 8 of the NDP, which talks very creatively and forcefully about land and special transformation. So that was the key guide, but over and above that, a number of other principles that are contained in other documentation, in PUMA, in the IEGF, etc., and came down to saying that whatever we do, we want to see spatial transformation, and we define it in those terms, in terms of justice, sustainability, resilience, quality, efficiency, and good administration, as it outlines so well in PUMA. This is just a demonstration that we went through the exercise of comparing and triangulating a number of national key priority documents and policy directives, including the NDP, PUMA, IEGF, our own MSP, and our own financial investment plan. And the ticks show that most of the principles that we put in, from spatial justice to spatial quality, efficiency, and administration, are reflected across most of them. It will be only the area of spatial quality, because of its nature, PUMA, necessarily provide for issues that include talking about appropriate spatial norms and standards, and some green economy interventions. Now, we've gone through the definitions, but these are some of the benefits that we think would be useful for the private sector to consider, specifically the private sector who comes into the public sector just now. That the private sector will have a sense of how government prioritizes, how government is committed to focusing certain resources. It will have a sense and a comfort that they don't have to be knocking at different doors to get a development approval table. That there will be a coordinated and intergovernmental support and alignment system, that when you engage on these capacity projects, you don't have to be walking through and plethora of departments at national level, at provincial level, or at municipal level, from the rates office, clearances, to approvals, to EIA approvals, etc., that we'll be trying to coordinate that. So it's a value add, or it's a value offering that we make to the private sector. And it's not private sector in terms of the business only, but any interest that's interested in developing our spaces, that's not the government. So it could be NGOs and other donor institutions or development houses. They're listed there, I think they are there in front of the tech, and we want them to be able, at the end of the day, to show that they can prioritize job creation and economic development and so forth. Outcomes for government, we want to offer scale. I said already that anything above 10,000 units, anything above 5,000 service stands, that's what we want in targeting. We look at the variety of housing typologies. We're not just looking at BNG houses or CRUs, but we want to see the variety of typologies of housing that government can offer. We want to mix our communities, not have enclaves of poverty in RDP houses, far away from bonded houses or other mixes of income. We want to be able to gear our government investment. The discussion that we had before, I think by 2017, when we have this consolidated development finance institution, we rely on institutions like that within our sector to be able to go out there, gear, leverage, take out our projects as we develop them, and go and face the market and raise capital and all that. We want to demonstrate sustainability over a long term. We also want to see collaboration between government as a whole and the private sector. We package together. There'll be a number of projects that are planted themselves to private-public partnerships. There are those that can be done by government on its own, and there are obviously going to be projects that the private sector would want to do on their own. And lastly, also the projects need to indicate the nature and type of government support that is required as we progress. I just wanted to make this example as well, that the economic benefits that we also want to see through the catalytic process, not just brick and mortar and building houses and ensuring that there are amenities, there are crashes, there are libraries, etc., But there's a strong economic ambition as well, that we want to be able to transform our economy. We've looked at examples from all over the world on how governments use the housing delivered of the human settlement delivered processes as a catalyst, for economic transformation and development. And we keep on referring back to Singapore, looking at some current UK and US example. There are examples in China where they can demonstrate that by improving, just improving the living conditions of our people, it has a benefit on especially on bridging the rural urban divide and ensuring reallocation of money, reallocation of migration of people from the peripheries to urban centers. Morocco provides a good practice example of how you can balance informal upgrading with social and rental interventions. And if you take all that value proposition, you wear an economic development cap, they have to be taken out by a number of other departments. So we are the initiators, human settlement drivers, but they should be taken out, economic and otherwise, from other players. This is not a definitive set of takeouts from a number of players, but we think these are some of the key ones. You look at manufacturing, you look at environment and health, on resource utilization. There's a whole list there, right from water to transport to energy, to looking at the different alternative technologies. And if you compare, if you pull all those together and you take them through what we anticipate will be the value chain to deliver the catalytic project, right from project inception, preparation and planning, right to completion over a 15-year period. These are some of the benefits that we'd be anticipating out of running these catalytic projects. Just a few points on process. The process was initiated by a call. We made a public call for interested parties to show interest from government and the private sector. We went through a process. We devised an assessment tool that we employed to look at all the proposals, and I'll give you the numbers of the proposals that we got, up to a point where we applied the assessment tool, came down to a number of projects that we thought met all the criteria, the NDP, the economic benefits, spatial integration, etc. We were all assessed through an assessment tool and got to a point where we would be ready to make a recommendation. So post making a recommendation, we ran a parallel process as well, that we started engaging the proposers. So if you come to us and say that this project meets all these requirements and the wonderful things that I've been saying before, and we needed to do some due diligence exercise. Go out there, do a technical due diligence, find out really for sure that what you're talking about is doable. And we are in the process of completing that. We've done most of the public sector proposals, and I think all of them by now we've done, and we will be able to present to the acting DG and the minister the full result of the technical assessment that we did. Post that, we'll be getting into a transaction mode where we now negotiate either with government or with the private sector on the exact deliverables, the costs, the funding, the resources, etc., that we require per project. This is the summary of the assessment tool that we used. There are two areas of criteria. One, we're looking at integration. And two, whether there's impact in terms of scale or impact in terms of whether it's the size of the projects that will be proposed. And we gave it a different weightings. Like, for instance, on the integration criteria, we looked at regional mass, we looked at the location of the site. If it's strategically located, it's not somewhere out there in the periphery where the cost of transportation will be too high for our people, and is it included in the municipal IDP, is it included in the municipal built environment performance plans and other plans for their capital investment plans that they might have? Do you talk to the metro sector? Very sophisticated plans, master plans, and all that. We wanted also to understand whether it would fit into building a built environment capacity in a specific geographic state. On the impact side, we looked at supply and demand areas. Is it going to be addressing local needs as well? Are we going to be able to get local people participating and benefiting out of the exercises? Is there innovation? And also, we scored economic activity, and I have to bid more on economic activity. We scored that the highest 40. So any application would score out of 155. So we applied that, and this is the net return that we got. From government, we got 82 projects that were submitted. From the private sector, we got 85 projects, giving us a total of 167. But out of those, there were 8 that were duplicates, were independent of each other. The private sector interest in a particular municipality would make the same submission as government. And there were about 8 of them across different provinces, 3 in the Eastern Cape, 3 in the Free State, 2 in Gauteng. I think those were areas where we had most of the duplication. So we then went through adjudication and other processes in between. And after adjudication, looking at the maximum threshold of 60% for both private and public proposals, we came down to a point where we have 44 government proposals and 59 private proposals, giving us a total of about 103. And of that, there were 20 that we through adjudication, thought we could easily match. We presented independently, and as we go through the assessment, we found a couple that would best be matched as single projects and not as independent projects. This was a very important slide, Chair, that it shows us this is face value when people present to us and say that it will cost so much. So it's still subject to the due diligence that I'm talking about and further financial modeling once we start getting into a transaction mode. But they seem to yield over a period of 5 to 15 years, I think you say 5 to 15 years there, a combined total of 342 billion that will be in the cost, split into 239 projects that come from the private sector, and about 102 billion from the company sector. If you go with this modeling, I think I'm not saying that Gotham Bo is sitting next to you. I think the intention as well would be to try and, as much as possible, to crowd in private sector.
Who's that? Who's Bo?
The acting director general of the Department of Civil Settlements of South Africa. Okay. So that's just an illustration, Chair. We want to give you a strong sense that in considering where the projects are and going through what are defined as the master special plan, we looked at population growth across the country. We used different data sets, but essentially I think we're relying on the census sets. We looked at growth and employment in the country. We looked at migration patterns and the movement of our people, where we are people moving from, especially from within the country, not so much from outside the country. We looked at where the housing needs are through our housing needs registers and other data sources. And we looked at total gross daily air that extends in the country at the moment. And having used those maps, we then started looking at some of our key programs and priorities that are current. there's obviously informal settlement and upgrade in areas, so to speak, in the times where they are reflected in blue. We looked at our current mining towns, being mindful of the interministerial efforts at national level to upgrade, or especially looking at the human settlement side of our mining towns. I think there are about 22 of mining town areas across the country. And then we look at what we define as areas of deprivation. They are very important areas in our country, but that's where the highest deprivation would be. Either economic deprivation, social, relatively political, but these are areas of deprivation that we also mapped across the country. As you can see, areas just outside your last areas in identified around the East London region. And then we looked at areas of high investment potential, areas where an investment is not only calculated in terms of return of investments as the private sector is defined. It would be a high investment area if we get the highest return in terms of employment creation, creating more opportunities for people to access amenities, better or lower transportation costs, that people pay less on transportation to get to areas, to opportunities, either employment or pay less to go and watch a football match and stuff like that. So investment potential is multi-fold as well. Looking, and then we pull them all together and go through this definition that will be useful going forward. That if you combine all those, then we have in the country all those shaded areas, and we're defining them as our specially prioritized municipalities across the country. So if you ask us what would be specially prioritized in the country, we'll tell you that it's in those municipalities across the country. And then we started looking at the number of needs. If you look at housing needs in those specially prioritized countries, municipalities, you find that the dark green there, that's where we have the highest need for housing. Under 100, the light green would be between 100 and 500 housing needs. And the, what's this color here?
Yellow.
The orange shade would be where we have 500 to 1,000 units per block. And you see that there's an emerging pattern here that will show that if you move from where we are now and you run across the South Coast to the East Coast to KZN, the pattern will always end up with a big dot around the Gauteng complex, because of all of that. Gauteng would be including parts of Polokwane, parts of in that definition. So the Gauteng complex will go right up to Brest, Mahikeng in some instances, my covenant the mining town, etc. So I just want you to be mindful of that pattern there that you see emerging over and over with the different deliberations that we have on our MSG. This is where the highest need is. And again, that pattern there emerges. That the highest need would be in that campaign, Limpopo, Northwest, Mpumalanga complex, with a bit of a spread in the south, in the east to south coast, and coming into the western state and the Cape Town area. So, and then we looked at over 5,000. This is where, obviously, that our most interventions should be coming in terms of meeting housing needs. Then we looked at specially prioritized municipalities, also from a different angle, in terms of population. I was reprimanded for using some of the population categorizations, and this is what the census still uses. They still call us Asians, they still call us Black, they still call us White. If you try to define it otherwise, I think you might confuse your argument a bit. But that's where the Asians are, is where White people are. Same pattern, although the graphs might be lower. This is where the colored people are. provinces where the majority of the black or African population. I don't want to get into those categories. I think let's use the categories that we are used to. But again, it takes that the large comma pattern across the country. You do a breakdown in terms of population densities. As you looked at population densities per partial in a specifically per server. So there's a densification per server. You get the same pattern if you use the same color category. We're looking at population just to get to the slide, to be able to demonstrate that the catalytic project at the end of the day needs to be able to address where the majority of our population is and where the majority of our population that requires to benefit is located. And we are convinced that they are located in 80% of our population. 60% of the 80% of our population is located in the special clarified municipality as we define them, and so on and so forth. Now, we looked again at the same specially clarified municipalities and looked at their economic activity, used the GVA contribution at the city. We looked at the general government location. Obviously, these are some of the provincial capitals as well, the national capitals. We looked at agriculture. Agriculture takes a much more different spatial spread than the comma that we've been looking at. And you'll see the same with mining, that this is where the wealth of our country is underground. But if you go back to manufacturing, you look at electricity and gas, you look at construction, it goes back to that East Coast, West Coast, Gauteng complex, Mpumalanga, and south of Limpopo, east of the northwest and north of the Free State, transport, we said finance and insurance. There's obviously a big concentration around the Gauteng area, and all your insurance and equity and social security and equity is people here. I think our friends from our new institution want to spend more time here. Then we look at community and social and so on. So then we started looking at the different corridors. These are all the important corridors in the country. These are the cities. These are the transport corridors that have been constructed, self-conceived, etc. These are your priority cities, municipalities, I guess. Yes. These are our municipalities. We looked at their rivers and dams, the little dams there, there's a little farming somewhere there. There's one important city that's an island because of its proximity to the sun, which is Scar, sitting here. But you see there's an important corridor that runs through the Scar area, which is C5. Right? Then you look at then brought back those partially prioritized municipalities on top of the cities, and you could see the coloration that most of them are where the cities are, where the corridors are, where the dams are, where the roads are, where the cities municipalities are, and there's a nice correlation. But remember that the partially integrated project also looked at mining towns and the informal settlement upgrading and other interventions. And then we did the plotting there. So we took all that and engaged them with the proposals that are coming in from government and the private sector. And so we come up with a project which wants to see where it's located on that map. And fortunately, all those that were recommended, we won't show the private sector much at the stage, but we see there's a lot of government projects in that
just a complex that I was speaking about, as they follow the same pattern along Etekwini, the East Coast, running from the East Coast towards the West Coast, and also a few here. There will be one or two, I think, in the inner land, in Mangaung, the north of the northwest, and this is where the 44 that we are recommending to the minister are located, and we are confident that they are located onto our special map. So we then prioritize the utilization of state land. This is the current available usage of state land, and we're demonstrating how state land lies adjacent. Most of it will be inside our prioritizing areas, but there are quite a few that lie outside our strip areas that might present some challenges for us going forward. Obviously, some of that is the Kruger National land, and I'm sure you don't want to house our people there. Then, at a funding level, it's a broad proposal that we're making on funding. It's about crowding in funding. That there has to be very serious conversations between our minister and cabinet counterparts about pooling funding. We need funding for bulk and connector services, which is largely driven through MIG, with one slice of that. We have our own funds through the USDG and the HSDG that we could use also to develop the public amenities or services for those to develop. But we want also to get funding from outside from the market, funding for top structures and gap housing, etc. The key issue there is that we want combinations and a variety of combinations and arrangements that need to be adapted on specific project requirements. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. Different projects might require different combinations. This slide illustrates it even better. It shows what the HSDG at the moment funds. It's most likely top structures and some internal services. The USDG funds, in most cases, the land, it will be bulk infrastructure, specifically in the metro municipalities, and some internal services. There's some elements of USDG that will use public services and public amenities, and some elements of the USDG that goes into what we define as bulk environment and land and natural resources. These are some of our own, like, trips, but most of these are our sister or brother departments that will have to come to the party, starting from electricity, looking at the rural, RBIC, by the way, people used to call it RBIC and all that, but that's the water and sanitation, I think, grant that comes from the Department of Water and Sanitation. There's the NGPG, I think it's mostly targeted at urban towns and cities for development funding. They also finance water, electricity, and other bulk services. So we want to crowd in all those ones per project and be able to run the catalytic project. So, as the way forward, we're still consulting, we're still in the consultation mode. We still have to sit down and look at multi-year planning and phasing and staging of projects as we await formal political approvals we make. At a technical level, we need to be able to be combat ready if they are approved, to say that we've got the systems, we've got the plans, we can manage and develop proper pipeline management and proper thinking and how the place has changed over the 15 years. We'll have to have consultations on what if we need to go on joint ventures, considering fencing or soft slicing or some of our capital grants. The discussion, I think, that will be difficult, but it has to be had with the provinces and MECs and
Grand Committee, engaged with the important sector department, treasury on support program, and some of these consultations have been had. I think when we get into discussions, people might be able to give us. These are the recommendations that we took to MINMEC. We thought it would be useful for us to share with yourselves here. But we asked MINMEC to approve the declaration of the project. What we can't do, Chair, I'm not sure if that disclaimer has to be made now, but we can't go into the details of the private sector project for the moment, because we still have to complete the procurement process. So until we communicate with them or the minister makes an announcement, we won't be able to talk about those details. But we have shared some insights with the MPs as instructed by the minister from MINMEC. But these are the recommendations that MINMEC looked at and approved. I think going forward, the acting DG and the COO might want to elaborate on some of the immediate next steps that have to do with the executive authority with the cabinet. I'm not privy to those. Maybe they can talk more authoritatively on those next steps.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mloy, CEO of Housing Development Agency. Mr. Cheney.
Thank you, Chair.
Like you are ready to talk.
Chair, just to follow up on Mr. Mloy's point, Chair, what we can confirm is that part of the process involves us going through the cluster committee, so it's the economic cluster based on the economic impact of this, the social protection cluster. There's also the IMC on basic services, which is also we've presented to that, and then Minister, he's also of course taking this to Cabinet for formal chair. We've also then requested the provincial department, because although we've got, you know, I think what we've tried to do is to ensure that there's consensus across the clusters. As well as formal cabinet endorsement of ministers' proposals. We've asked that the MECs take this to the provincial cabinet so that there is provincial alignment, and then what we can confirm, Chair, is that all the projects that we have received have also received formal approval by the municipal council. So there's that alignment. In relation to what we've been able to achieve on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Changana, anything you want to say? Understand. Thank you so much for that presentation. I think I have to say reluctantly so, this is a well-prepared presentation.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have to give that credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good one. And obviously, having said that, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. But really, the presentation is really good. We're quite comfortable with the fact that it has catered for everything that we have raised previously when you came to present the issue of the vulnerable groups. You have covered the issue of the integration and impact is covered totally. The issues of making sure that this time around, when you do this planning, it actually deals with the spatial planning. I think, for me, that's the most important thing, and I think I'm very comfortable with that. But obviously, I'm going to hand over to honorable members to raise questions and clarities, and take it from there. Honorable Bada, followed by honorable Stole, followed by honorable Memezi, followed by honorable Ghana, and honorable Mungangatwamash.
Oh, sorry, we don't have any questions.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mloy, the CEO of ACA. Maybe I need to introduce myself. I intended that side.
Excuse me?
Okay.
Okay.
The presentation is good, and I want to agree with the chair to say the presentation is very good. I mean, it talks to what exactly integration of communication is all about. And having said that, I was looking forward to your presentation, Mr. Mulumi, to check in terms of the minister. Remember, she said in her 5-year term, she would like to see 1.5 million housing opportunities. So my question to you is, if you calculate from now until 5 years, where are we going to be? And I was also very concerned on page 29 when you said some of the projects will run from between 5 to 10 years. Because I was asking myself that, wow, with this kind of presentation, perhaps it's possible that we can reach that 1.5 million. But I understand with human sentiment that some of the projects, they go along for so many years. And then in terms of the planning, even though you said in your way forward that you are in consultation with other spheres of government like the municipalities and also provinces, but I think I'm very much interested to understand now, where are you in terms of that planning? And obviously, in part of your integration, you also spoke to economic activity. And I thought you can have that give the figure to say, if all goes well, we receive the funding with the municipalities buy in, the provinces buy into this idea, perhaps how many job opportunities are we looking at? And thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. All on the line.
My first question is, first of all, we have to thank the department and Obabu Mdoli for this presentation. But my first question, Chairperson, in 2014, when the minister announced that he's going to do 50 cataracts.
Yeah.
What I want to find out, how many have been completed so far? How many have been completed so far? And the other one, Chairperson, I want to find out how far with their consultation with the other spheres of government, because they say they are in this consultation. So I want to find out how far with their consultation. And the other one, Chairperson, My worry, Chairperson, is that queue jumping. Because if you see, we don't have a policy on backyard dwelling. But now we have upgraded this informal settlement upgrading. There's a lot of queue jumping. What is the government doing to actually to align with that queue jumping that is happening in the country?
Yeah.
And the other one, Chairperson, is the issue of populations, because the population are growing. Migration is happening, especially in Gauteng. What are the, because there is no availability of land and resources, what the department are going to do on that issue, because it's actually the crisis. And if I do remember, Chairperson, when during the presentation of MP, National Development Plan. The then former minister says you have to shift some funds from other departments to CASA to informal settlement. Have you done that? If you have done, which department has been buying in on those proposals?
Honorable Kat, there's a serious competition there between you and Matause on telephones, eh? It depends on who uses it most. Honorable members, how about you? I wanted you to break that whole story there. Honorable members. Oh, sorry now. Okay. Honorable Kata says, I must correct it publicly that now it's Kata. It's not Kata, it's Ghana.
Thank you very much. You see, we can't make noise. Sometimes, back in the days, we'll send notes. So sometimes we communicate using our phone. Thanks for the presentation. I have a few questions on it. The first one, I think it was made. Last year or the year before, we're on 50 catalytic projects, and the one that APA is talking about is 44. Does this mean that the seats, which is the balance, are already concluded, or what happened with those ones? And secondly, one thing that I'll have liked to see in the report, which I did not see, is the extreme municipalities where these projects will be taking place. Because if we say that the proposals have already gone through the municipal council's approval in terms of council approving, I think we should have included that part in. But one of the biggest, I don't want to say it's the surprising figure there, it's Limpopo. You know, I come from Limpopo.
Yeah, I know. I know very well in other Sokan.
I mean, I'm not sure. It means the private sector development is moving to Limpopo. If these figures are to be correct, I mean, we only have 6,700 in terms of government and over 200,000 of private sector. And I mean, coming from Limpopo and knowing or being aware of the economic situation in Limpopo, I'm not sure, because the only other province that's above Limpopo is Gauteng with 280. So it unless this government is moving the capital to Limpopo, and there will be a lot of movement of us. I think these numbers are, I can agree with others, but Limpopo one is just sounds too high, especially when one looks at the migration pattern, that more and more people are going to the bigger cities. So now who's going to actually be buying the private development that will take place in Limpopo? And then maybe I'll the last one for me here. It's with regard to the land and this project being earmarked for a 10-year period. Does it mean that the land, because if you admit that as a province, like if you are in Popo and Mpumalanga, that you want to embark on this mega project over the next 10 years, does it mean that the land has already been secured, or is that the planning to say once you deliver houses, but then the HDA has to get us the land? And also the same question will go for private sector development, because simply private sector is going to deliver almost a million new houses. It's a massive piece of land that we have to look at. Has that land been identified, and what the thing? Because if the land has been identified, then the acquisition plans of in terms of getting the land that HDA is also involved in will not have to be done, because the land for the next 10, 15 years is kind of secure to be able to implement this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kana. Honorable Meme.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Thank you very much, Pascal Mloy. We all agree that your report is very comprehensive. One area that you emphasize is the economic side of this big project. What we would want to hear, how are you planning to ensure that the cake would be shared by many participants and a board in the same cake for the same company? So how are you ready to avoid that temptation of falling in love with one company when we have so many that one also share the day? South Africa belongs to all.
Who live in it?
In particular, those that were previously excluded would want a delivery focus to empower them, not one company. So I would love to hear your commitment in that, empowering those that were small and becoming bigger as well. But the cake must be shared, so are you ready to do that, avoid one company all the time?
Thank you. Honorable Nahakarash.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I just want to end also to add my value on the really the good work done by the department. The planning that really focuses on integrated social planning is now in line with the NDP, and we are very much happy to see that, and that should be the route that we always take in our department. Having said that, Chairperson, that in considering that special integrated planning, my concern is around, I heard you when you made a presentation that all other departments are on board at the national level. But my concern would be at the municipal level, where even the capable metros, some of them, there is not that integrated planning in terms. There will be a planning, and then three years down the line or 3 years down the line, especially transport department and electricity department, because they receive their grant from national treasury, they will tell you that their funds are not enough to cover the entire project. I would want us to, when you meet with the national treasury and the municipalities, zoom in that area really and focus on it, especially when we talk of transport corridors. Because whenever there's that kind of a project, your bus route must be there in time, and taxi routes and on the and electricity connection. That's where that even if the human settlement will provide the bus, but the connection they'll be left behind to those reasons that the grant from the national treasury is not enough to cover the entire project in a specific period. The other issue would be for me is that is the HDA now really going to be able to rise to the occasion? This is a moment past, and in terms of the capacity, what are you doing? Because as we said, we know that we are not fully capacitated. What would help you to unpack the plan that you have to capacitate yourself and be ready for the implementation of this project? In terms of all the disciplines, you know, the engineers, the planners, and one those really to be, especially the structural engineers, because the problem out there is, I know there's an NHPRC that will always assist that, but we want to know whether that, together with an NHPRC, is covered, because most cases we are lacking on the structural engineers. And then the economic activities will always stress that, because with this project as well, as much as we want that integrated planning, we want it to yield job creation. And how many, we want to know, how many jobs are you envisaged to create on this job? And the permanent job or and your whether you want to call it a temporary job or whatever you may call it. Chairperson, on the page that is after 68, page 68, you follow, I think it's the slide with the map, with the fourth one, that talks of the SIP, the municipalities in relation to strategic infrastructure projects. I'm on public-private partnership. You mentioned it, but if you look at the slide itself, the highlights that are explaining who is the contributor. The municipalities are still the biggest compared to the private sector. And for me, on the catalytic project, you will expect the matter contribution, more contribution by the private sector. And we would like to see clearly the role of the private sector in those. But having said that, but at the same time, we wouldn't want that the private sector determines the approach. We still want to lead, but as government, but the contribution, because you know sometimes we might be directed if we allow the other person to lead us in terms of what we want to achieve. Chairperson, thank you very much. This is really a very good question.
Thank you very much. I'm not allowing anybody else to talk. Yeah, did you have your hand up, Honorable Club? Oh, I didn't see you. Okay. Honorable Club.
Mine is a very few. I would just like to have a sense, of two things that have been mentioned here. Remember, we say there's this thing we mentioned of restructuring the project. And I don't think we want to see those restructuring patterns by 2050. We think we hit that by then they'll be done. But next thing to me, there should be a way of seeing them now. And then we also mentioned that there should be by 2050 there will be a measure of progress towards breaking the commercial that phrase is a euphemistic polite, which is a measure of progress. I would like to be aggressive on this part because this is these are the things which are real.
Thank you, Honorable Kappa. Department will respond. Obviously, some of the questions that are specific, you won't be able to respond until after probably this has been approved by the cabinet. But really, we're handing over to you to respond, not into detail, briefly. Zoom in, and so that we can move on.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to address one point as requested. Chair, in relation to the 1.5 million housing opportunities, I think it's important to note that at the time that Minister announced, not all of that 1.5 is going to come from the catalytic projects. As in when the catalytic projects come on stream, those projects will contribute because there are other projects in place and programs in place that are contributing to that. So not all of not all of the 1.5 million comes out of the catalytic projects. As in when they come on stream, they will obviously contribute. And if they do come on during the course of this 5-year term, it will then contribute to that. And I think it's just important to note that. Thanks, Chair.
I would have loved really to respond to Member Carter, but I think the few have already addressed those points. But just to add that the number of projects ultimately that get approved will be subjected to a due diligence exercise. It was just the point about how many projects. This was raised by Member Stone and the one other member, that at the moment, what we have as proposed is not TC. We have 103 proposed projects on the table. So if they all succeed, by the way, when we say that we have 103, those are still subject to thorough scrutiny, checking what we call technical jurisdictions, etc. We might end up as the minister. But what the minister didn't promise, that we can go back to her budget speech, was that by the end of the midterm, she will have completed the catalytic project. Such that I've identified 50 catalytic projects that can last. I think I'm not speaking on behalf of the minister per se, but I think the intention was that we have 50 of those catalytic projects identified. If you go back to the budget speech. But at the moment, we are in a process of having said that we've identified 103. We're going to take them through serious scrutiny, bring some of them here, and make sure that what you put on the table is doable. And maybe also then respond to the last question that was raised, that by 2030, what we said in the NDP is that we have made significant progress. So if you take, and these 50 are not going to end now with this minute. I think there will be other processes that aim to identify others as we progress in 2020. But we want to be able to have a very strong measure of saying that whereas we had such, if you take a transportation measure, 60% of our Africans spend so much money moving from home to work. As a result of these types of interventions, that number should have reduced. We should be aiming by 2030, the inner position where we can demonstrate change. But we said that by 2050, these are where some of the targets came in, that by 2050, no South African should be aiming below the red bar. Okay. By 2050, at that time, we don't want any South African to be paying more than X amount of rent. Moving from work to home, or moving from home to Asia, or moving from home to a hospital, or to etc. So I think, and that's not our way, by the way. That's taken directly from the Minister of Development Plan. I'm not sure who the author is. So on there's just one other question about consolidation and consultation with other departments. It's an ongoing process that we engage with the different departments. The other key platforms are what the CEO mentioned, that we have to go to the platform, to the cabinet platform. We have to go to, and before you go to a cabinet platform, I'm sure the DGs meet at the technical level, they debate these issues, and we get agreement there. And at least at the point of getting to agree that these are the 103 or 44 governments and 59 private sector that were running, those agreements would have been kicked off at the DGs level. I think the test ultimately is whether or not to get a good process. The municipal departments, cross-departmental issues, I think they are critical, but we at the moment, we're going through the submission that they made. So we trust them that when they say this project is supported by their smarter development framework, or it's reflected in their municipal IT, or in their built environment plan, and that they have plans in terms of how they'll be allocating their budgets and resources. And fortunately, municipalities are able to show long-term, multiple years and capital investment plans, especially those that are bigger facilities. So we trust them when they say that, and we then do the evaluation that we did, and into a project that we just. But it doesn't end there. We're still going to go back. We're still going to go back there and want to see whether they have made those investments, and whether or not the housing department has spoken to the water and the safety department, and whether they've got community services and library and consulting. And that's part of the extra exercise going forward. So, gonna be the point. I think it's the panel that you have the highest activity of mining town development in the world. So if you look at the project base that we're doing there, the numbers that we that were showing you there, this is what we call, I'd like to say, unaudited numbers at the moment. This is the value that a government department or a private sector proposal would put all the things and say that in the Panama they were going to deliver so many housing units and so many libraries and schools, etc. Remember, this doesn't just cover the top structure. This is what it would take for us to put in bulk infrastructure and the topography in some of these areas, like probably doing the cost of the geotech and putting the AIA higher than other areas. So that's a total value proposition, which is still subject to details. But I'm not surprised that we have this higher number in the parliament, I mean, in the proposal. I'll stop there and maybe invite the SDG to add on one or two others that I might have touched on.
I think most of the questions have been covered, Chair. There was a question from Member Menezi about the empowerment objectives, about diversifying the portfolio and make sure that we don't fall in love with the team that is provided. I think if you look at the list, it's a pity we can't give that list out now, but if you look at the list, it's not one service provider. And through strategic acquisitions or strategic procurement, we'll be able to achieve those development objectives that you asked. I think most of the questions were covered by my colleagues. There was a question about crowding in the private sector. I think Number Abasha was raising a question about the fact that the numbers are not talking to that crowding in of the private sector. I think it's still a work in progress. We may end up with more private sector companies or developments than the government ones, because we need to get more contribution from the private sector and not so much from government. But that's work in progress. But if you stick to the 60% threshold, you will notice that more is coming from the private sector. But if you shift to the threshold to 70%, then it reduces the number of contribution from the private sector. But that's work in progress. And that's what the team, the due diligence team, is working on. Chair, we will continue to come here and present this work. And I'm sure next time when everything else has been approved, we'll be able to give you a distinct impression of what we want to achieve. The project will give you those designs, the layout, the drawings, the map, everything that you would want to know the project. But we can't do it at this stage because we have not completed the exercise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Changane. We would be very interested in that progress report, because if you look at this, this is going to be our legacy, Honorable Sabasha, because it's going to change the landscape of human settlement in the country. And at least even if some of us are not here, we'll be able to be happy to say we've made some progress in terms of changing how the country is planning. I think we're going to go straight now to the next presentation. I know that I'm pressing you for time. The NHDRC is going to present to us on the rectification program, which is the last input from the department. We know that where's the chair of the board and the CEO. I know that Mongezinyani can speak until cows come home. So you have to time him and tell him that stop now. So yeah, but luckily you are the last presenter, so you are pressed for time, sir.
Chair and members, good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity. Chair, I will not want to be long, rest assured, I'm not going to be talking today. We have come to the committee to brief you about the policy development on the remedial program. You will know that the minister made a pronouncement
that it was getting done on rectification. Mm. And therefore, between ourselves and the department, we were tasked by the minister to go and look for proposals on how they present this program forward, given that indeed government is spending money because of the rectification. But the issue that the minister was concerned about is saying, going forward, what do we do then? So we've been working with the department, and as I said, I'm not going to be talking today. Mr. Nontlanga Buthelezi, who's in the policy section, we've been working with him, he's going to take you through the policy. That is still a draft, Chair, but we're coming to consult you as a committee, because before it's finalized, the committee can also make its inputs. It's going to go through to minimum for approval, but once that has been done, we'll therefore implement the policy going forward. Whilst at the same time, finalizing those projects that are currently under ratification. So I'm just going to hand over to Mr. Buthelezi, who's going to take you through the proposal, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members.
Hi.
This is basically our proposal regarding the social program. Like the CEO has indicated, we have had the rectification program, which emanated from a number of programs that the department had. We had what we call the pre-1994 rectification program and also the post-rectification program. But what has given us the policy foundation is part of the pronouncements that have been made by our minister in terms of the foundation to say the rectification program is one of those programs we should not be embarking upon. It started upon when she made her budget speech on around the 14th of August, 24th to 14th. Where she was indicating that we have spent too much money on the program and it's excessive. We should be ensuring that the contractors build properly and ensure that the certificates are awarded by the NHDRC. So in terms of the speech, other speeches that we had is around the pronouncement on the 7th of May where she had indicated that we are no longer rectifying using the budget that is allocated in the department. We have since the department issued directives to all the provinces requesting them to tone down in terms of the rectification program so that we can be able to introduce the remedial program. And what we are proposing is basically a policy that seeks to phase out the rectification program so that we can be able to undertake the remedial program. What we've done basically as part of the policy is just to come up with a framework which covers all the aspects that are reflected on the scheme. But the key aspects around us understanding each other when we talk about certain things like rectification, what is it that we are referring to? When we say remedial, what is it that we are referring to so that we can be on the same wavelength? When we talk about rectification, we are talking about the pre-1994 program that was there in the early days where we were basically saying it's properties that were inherited from the previous government, with some of them when we had undertaken to transfer some of the properties, we were saying it's properties which are not in a proper state, which we should be transferring to certain individuals for them to own them, but unfortunately we could not do that because they were not properly constructed, so it led to us trapping the rectification program. When we talk about remedial, we are talking about the structural work that we are supposed to undertake in terms of remedying some of these structurally unsound buildings that have been developed in the past, which led to some of the challenges that we are seeing. Government ended up building, spending 2 billion rands around it. So what we've introduced is the process of assessment, which we basically say is a forensic way of establishing whether a property needs to be rectified or not, or it needs to be remedied. What we are introducing as well is the terminology of self-help, where we are saying communities, in as much as government has been providing part of the ENG stock, communities should be playing a role in relation to participating in terms of remedying what needs to be reconstructed. We have also introduced terminology such as defective, which we are defining it in relation to the stock that is there, which would have been classified under the home building manual that is administered by the NHDRC. And we also termed what we call problematic municipal services, within rectification or remedial work, there is some municipal engineering services which have contributed to the scope that we are saying needs to be remedied. So I've given you this as a way of being able to separate the differences, because oftentimes we talk about rectification and currently we are talking about remedial work which needs to be done. And the remedial work is coming from the fact that you had the NHGRC, which was a legislation which was enacted around 1998, and the institution itself being operational around 2002. So part of it is what's coming from the fact that you have the DSG strategy, which was basically saying, let us enhance the quality of the residential products so that we can be able to deal with the increase in terms of the transfer of property. I've explained the issues that are emanating from the pre-1994 to say there was that stock which we had calculated and ended up noticing that it was needed to be rectified. In terms of what has since transpired, the transition between 2002 up to 2010, where the department had also identified that after the NHGRC was put in place, there was that slow uptake in terms of the houses, but what needed to be done is the process of ensuring that all the houses need to be covered within that period. But unfortunately, because of maybe the slow uptake that we had, it ended up creating that gap in terms of the program. What we did was to craft a program which we call rectification, which we discussed at the NIMEC level, and it had a time frame which was the 1st of April 2012. And it had to be finalized by the 31st of March 2014. As a department, we have looked at it in terms of the business plans that are there, and we've done sort of a situational analysis after the instructions were issued to say we should not be doing rectification. In terms of the overall business plans that we have stocked to the tune of 6,893, which has been allocated a budget of about 613 million rand in the current financial year business plan. In terms of the analysis in the KZN province, these are the properties that are affected, which are currently reflected in terms of the provincial business plan. You have properties around the Namibia, Ladysmith and Dumeni area, which is where KZN is basically saying we have challenges around rectification. But this is the stuff that we are saying it was there between the period of 1994 up to 2002 when the NHGRC was being set up. In terms of the other provinces like Free State, these are the numbers which we have, which are around the specific municipalities where we are basically saying this is what we are targeting, areas such as Kisosoma and local municipality in Seneca, where we have two-room houses which are reflected in terms of their delivery statistics. In the Northwest, these are the projects that have been indicated. They are under the areas such as Ibilin, where you have stocks around the figures there which are reflected, but these are the areas which we are basically saying we are looking at stock between 1994 up to 2004. Our challenge as a department is the fact that we have the program, but in terms of the rectification itself, we have realized that the program is costing so much, and we have done an expenditure review which has been costed through our national treasury, which was basically identifying the challenge to say as government we tend to be spending more and over and above the current cost of our ENG house. And we also identified the fact that there are also political pronouncements which have been made in areas such as the Northern Cape, where in part of the state of the province addressed there was an indication of stock of around 700 and contracts which had already been signed. We had also identified the challenge that we have. We are unable to hold some of the contractors accountable. So part of the proposal that I'm bringing today is about ensuring that our contractors are held accountable. Over and above that, we identified the issues of double subsidization in relation to the fact that you would have received the VNG house, but at the same time, we will come back and rectify or remedy what has been constructed before. In terms of the policy outcome, we are basically looking at what is reflected in terms of the NDP and the MTSF outcome to say we want to improve the functioning of the residential property market, because without a functional residential property market, we won't be able to trade properly so that we can be able to move those who are on the lower ladder of the housing chain to the higher level. And we have raised a lot of legitimate expectations which needs to be fulfilled around the pre-1994. In terms of the objectives that we are putting, we are saying we want to facilitate the use of the self-help approach, which will minimize the cost of doing the remedial work. And we want to encourage beneficiaries to advise government on the substandard work which is in need of remedial action. We also want to facilitate investigation in relation to the shoddy work that has been done, which will lead to us being able to blacklist some of the contractors that have been that have compromised quality. We also want to ensure that the contractors, they take back part of the funds which they have used in terms of building the stock in the event that the forensic investigation indicates to us that it was on the part of the contractor to be able to fix. And we also want to provide various forms of conducting the remedial action, especially around the funding mechanisms, because that's where our issues are. I'm not going to dwell much in terms of the principles because that talks to around some of the issues that I've already alluded to. In terms of the scope of our policy, we are saying we want to cover the pre-1994 stock up to 2011, including what is covered under the THP program. We want to focus on properties that are belonging to municipalities or even to the provincial government, because partly currently we still have stock that is still regarded as stock that is under our books as government, and it should have been stock that has that gets transferred to individuals. So we won't be able to transfer such stock without remedying them up to the right standard so that beneficiaries can be able to have that. We want to cover remedying in terms of the stock where we've identified that there are very serious hazardous health and safety issues that have compromised the stock that has been built, but it could be areas that are around inappropriate design and construction methods that have been utilized. In terms of the quick grip, we are saying we will be focusing on residential properties that have been transferred to beneficiaries, and we will be ensuring that each and every beneficiary where we are doing the remedial way, each beneficiary must provide us with a written consent in terms of access to to the property that where we will be doing the remedial way, so that there will be improvement. We will be also focusing on municipal engineering services that require upgrading or improvement. And in that space, knowing with an understanding that we have funding such as the USDC and the MIG funding, which are geared up for covering the engineering services. So part of what we are saying is that where we have stock that has been affected because of bad engineering services, we will be partnering with the sector departments such as COSA and the municipalities which are receiving the MIG funding. And we will be able to exclude certain properties which we are of the view stock that should not have been covered. With such stock, we are talking about the current stock which is there around the government buildings, which basically where you have government employees, where even the members of parliament are being housed, so that when we remedy it, we are not covering those. In relation to the technical norms and standards, we all acknowledge the issues that we have around the safety and health conditions of the dwellings that we have, and we are saying it should be we should be able to use the current building practices where we are focusing on the latest norms and standards around what needs to be developed, and we should not be compromising quality based on what exists on the ground. In terms of the targeted beneficiaries, we are basically saying our key focus it should be prioritizing around the vulnerable groups, and specifically we are focusing on those who are aged, we are focusing on those who are physically disabled or challenged. We are also going to focus on pregnant women and child-headed households. And we are also saying in the event that there is work in terms of the previous program, we need to be able to engage with the heirs of the now registered owners of the properties, because those are the people who will be, who are supposed to trade in terms of the residential property market. In terms of the funding mechanism, we are proposing that we have currently the funding arrangements where we talk about the warranty fund, which is the fund that is administered by the NHDRC. We are also having repayments which will be made by the contractors depending on whether we'll be able to get such funding. We will be also requesting beneficiaries to contribute some credit equity or some percentage, and over and above that, we are talking around monies that will be appropriated by Parliament as part of the funding mechanism. But the key proposal around this is for us to be able to propose a split in terms of the funding arrangement, to say for the original beneficiaries, we should be proposing maybe a 60-40 split, where the original beneficiaries at least are able to contribute a percentage. In this case, we are proposing a 40%. And in terms of those who have already purchased the home, we are proposing a 90-10 split, where government only contributes about 10% and the original owner contributes about 90%. We are aware that the program is likely to lead to sitting of existing contracts which are there in terms of provincial plans, because maybe some of them, looking at the MTF allocation, they had looked at them in terms of the long term. And we are of the view that even that we are saying we are not going to utilize HSBG funding to be able to do the rectification, we will be looking at those contracts and ensuring, so that we ensure that the remedial work is undertaken through the NHDRC. In terms of monitoring and evaluation, part of the policy we are saying each and every province must quantify in terms of the number of properties that are in need of remedial work. And we are also saying as a national department, we will be setting up a national register of contractors over and above the existing contract register that is there in the NHDRC. We will be looking at the details of the contract, the deviations that have since happened, and the actions that need to be undertaken in terms of dealing with the shoddy workmanship, and be specific around the sanctions that will be applied for specific contractors. We are aware there could be limitations in relation to the last part, depending on whether some of the companies are still in existence, but we are of the view that putting up this register will be able to assist government in terms of dealing with the best practices that have since happened. In terms of the institutional arrangements, we are proposing that the key stakeholders should still play the role in relation to the remedial program: the national department, the provincial human settlement department, the municipalities, and the NHDRC. But the key aspect around this is to say the NHDRC is the one which will be assisting us in terms of ensuring that the remedial program gets implemented. We have a number of reforms which we are proposing in terms of the role of the NHDRC, where we are saying it has to assess, it has to assist in terms of educating the beneficiaries around their roles and responsibilities, and also playing a role around implementation. This, I think, is it in short, Chair. I hope I did not take much of your time.
Even if you had, I was going to allow you, because you are the only woman who presented today. Thank you so much, Mr. Phillips. Thank you for that presentation. And this probably is going to help, because I know that honorable members, this is one area that when we debate, is one area that everybody wants to concentrate on, the rectification, the waste of resources. One-on-one. So at least it tries now to give us more terms. We talk of self-help, we talk of remedia. So we will use those terms now when we debate honorable partner. I will take hands up to now. I see honorable Sole want to talk. Hey, you all want to talk? Okay, let me accept you now. Okay. Honorable Tole, Honorable Makausi, Honorable Papa, Honorable Ghana, Honorable Khurai, Honorable Memezi, and Honorable Nalakabash. In that order. Oh, before you speak, Honorable Tole, I don't know if you've noticed, your friend has joined us. Honorable Chauke, welcome. to this committee. He's joining the committee representing the ANC. Thank you so much. He's a new chair. From Northwest, those that don't know him. Uchawuki.
Thank you, Captain. Captain, first of all, we must thank the work for the report because it helped us. But man, Captain, as we were checking, it was really much better. When we checked the district, there was nothing that on the yard. Because there's a lot of houses that are deleted at most in Ward 14 and number. So what happened there? What the partner about
that? If they didn't present to the department, it won't come to the presentation.
Yeah. And the other one, Captain, is that one of companies that has been left with us. They have a number, how many companies have been registered. And the other Captain is that the contractor is supposed to pay the department. If they have managed, how many contractors have been paid back the money to the department because of their poor workmanship. And the last one, Captain, is that one of the housing. How much has this been so far for the verification of those projects? Because my concern, Captain, we were doing oversight in the city. There were houses in cities in the area of what I remember. There were houses that were identified, and they were supposed to be re-identified. Yes.
Okay, thank you so much, Honorable Sole. Honorable Matau.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just on the stock that was identified in the past for rectification. The Northern Cape is not on your presentation. I would like to know a bit of clarity around that. The houses that the roofs that that have asbestosis. They also part of the process that is going to be rectified. And also my question, are you working hand in hand with other departments in terms of if those houses are identified, are you able to make recommendations in terms of paying the people something,
Thank you very much. Honorable Papa.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also join my colleagues in appreciating the report, because this is one which gives us hope, because it's no more lamentation, it's remedial. Remedial is binding. Now, there is this one of the companies which are supposed to pay back the money. Is it possible, or how is it possible that you can guarantee that even those who have run away, or those who have disappeared, or those who have been duplicated, whatever that happens, because some of them maybe they give this short work because of their poor performance and they disappear. What's going to be done? How are we going to go around that situation where we don't have them, or we can't get hold of them, pay, and we have to pay the money back? I think that was one. The other one, which was worrying me, but only like I know, is that where the target included. Pregnant women. I don't know if you're suggesting that can be pregnant is something true, but maybe you can explain that in what sense does it come.
Honorable Khan, I'm not going to comment on the last comment. Honorable Khan.
Thanks very much, Chair. Chair, I'm starting in the second last slide. I think the only thing that we can do is to note the way that
absence of we can't support a policy that is presented in a skeleton fashion. I think it's unfair on us as a committee to be presented with a skeleton of a policy proposal, and then we are asked to support it. You know, it's only fair that we know that you are doing on something, and then we can ask that you present with us the full policy. Because I don't think what you have presented before us is the full policy. So that I'll amend the last part, Chair, that we don't support this thing until we get the full policy. The point that I want to get to, because now we are saying getting more serious. Because now we are saying that we are looking at the houses.
Notification is a hot topic, sir.
Yeah, I'm sitting next to someone who has the blood from the book and gets very hot.
Just like that, yes. I understand, Honorable Chauke. Honorable Kana, continue. This is rectification we discussed.
Yeah. Because we are looking at what this policy seeks to do is to look at the houses built up until 2011. And then we are now in 2016. Are we saying those ones that we have paid for and the contractors have already used the money built after 2011 are excluded from this policy proposal? Because your proposal is that we look up until 2011. And then the other one, I know we want to say we blacklist contractors, then we blacklist the firms or the organizations or the companies that got the work. But then the people inside those companies are not blacklisted. You know, for me, I will amend that when you look at the policy, that it's the owners of the companies that need to be blacklisted. So that you don't come today as HH Construction, then you are blacklisted, then tomorrow you come with something, Chauke Construction.
Ghana Construction.
It goes through. So I think we need to go deep and blacklist the people inside the organizations, and the police must be clear on that. And then the last one, Chair, they say I'm not speaking for long. The last one is around when we go forward. As we go forward, are we with this policy? Are we saying that the contractors will not be paid the last train until NHGRC has given the certificate? And if NHGRC has given the certificate, the rectification cost thereof, because you have given the certificate, the house falls apart, now the NHGRC will carry the cost going forward. So it will no longer be a department issue, it will now become an NHGRC cost that will be carried in. I just need to be clear on that one. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Honorable Kurai.
Sir, thank you very much, and let me also thank the presentation. My support. I also support the committee to support this committee. But why not to add until 2015 financial year? Secondly, I look at the page that has like growing, which is free state. Mm-hmm. Really, I'm concerned because I see it's only number of towns, and I'm sure my town has also had some lot of presentation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what you're talking about, what you've been completed or not completed, because I don't see my town.
Your town?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My area. Where I'm from. My problem.
My problem.
Another question. How many money is we spend for this certification? If we can assist us by programming, so that we can follow up on this. And whether the process of this certification is completed or not. I'm also going to say this one of the blacklisted companies. Really want to talk about honorable color. So say, can't you have another way of trying to be exact when we focus? So that because we must not use the name of the company. We must go deeper to the person using his identity. So that we must equally tell the depth of the matter where it is. And if it's possible, for those that know, can you give us the link so that we can name and change this contract that has done this horrible thing in our at our expense. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I think my points are covered, but one thing is clear. Chanda, thank you very much. I think your presentation is a bit hot, so everybody is sweating now that you have presented. So maybe Chanda and the department, the police should be informed by what is on the ground. Because if your timeline is not inclusive of what is on the ground, you will be forced to amend again. So let's make an example. Two provinces, KZN and Eastern Cape, at least have a bigger number of the remedial actions. But the province that is also needing, in terms of what is on the ground, more is Gauteng, but you only have 100 there. So it's clear there's something wrong in your situational analysis. Even if you go to Tswane alone, that's Karankua, Mabopane, Winterfell, that area, don't go to the other. You see? So you will get more than 1,000. So it's clear now going to Soweto, going to Eburuleni. So it's clear your situation analysis has some problems. Now you will be forced, if you're making a policy, you rather do that so that you are not forced to go back because the policy didn't really include all these areas. So which means even the timelines must be inclusive of what is on the ground. Because people can force you by doing. You can ignore some of these projects that are standing there are unfinished. But people will force you now. They know how to attract you to them. So I think you rather move on your own before you are forced. Northwest, you only say there are so few. It can't be true. It can't be true. Chauke, that's a municipality called
Honorable Chauke. Honorable Chauke.
Honorable Chauke would have just one small municipality called the FSA. Would have more than 100 that need some rectification. A lot of other municipalities. So, in clear this situational analysis, I can do better than each. So I think people must really show that they have indeed done some work. So it's not really acceptable. I think I am clear with what Honorable Ghana was saying, Honorable Kodai was saying. When you blacklist the company, blacklist the owner, use even their names and IDs. Not one of them, both the name, both the owner with their IDs. And when you list all of them, you don't choose, and then others you don't, because that would mean you're not consistent with your policy. So list all of them. I think that's what must be done. You have spoken about this thing of blacklisting for some time now. Is this done, or are you still contemplating? For the last 5 years, I've been hearing about this blacklisting. So is it done, or are you scared to do it? So what is stopping? Because we have said as policymakers, sometimes back, that these people must be blacklisted. What is stopping if there's something stopping? So I think that is the area. I think I agree with Ghana that the policy must have more muscle, more detail, so that
you are not forced to go back to it. So I think this is a good first presentation by a lady to go and now add more. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. We welcome the good presentation. And if you want to remember the other, I think we're in the first year in your presence. Now, we declare this in chat Chairperson, on a serious note, Chairperson, I take the blacklisting issue as a serious omission on the part of the department. Really is an omission, because since we arrived here in 2014, we've been talking about the blacklisting of companies and owners, the directors and other members of the board and of the management of the company. I recall when Wendy, then the DG Zulu, I can't remember, no, it was an acting CEO, responded by saying that it's something that really is within the National Treasury. That in terms of whether we have to link with the National Treasury or whatever, but let's get it done. Let's get it done. And the policy, now we can't miss that opportunity when we're dealing with this policy. And then the second one, Chairperson, on the remedial versus ratification, if I understood you correctly, that is it. Now that the listed provinces and municipalities are still going to interrogate them and separate what is ratification or remedial. If that is the case, I'll leave it at that, because it needs more work needs to be done, and you still come with more clarification as other members were raising those issues. But that takes me to the point that I raised earlier on with the HDA. That says that those shoddy work that makes us to go back by those companies, it's because at municipal level, provincial level, and national level, we are lacking on the structural engine as a type public sector. We rely on the consultants as well. They are in business, and those companies are in business. So we ought to have, now that we have an NHBRC, we ought to have to invest on the structural engineers. That's my point. But the defect, the policy must be able to say, to differentiate the defect that as a result of the companies or contractors, then the defect that requires the maintenance of the house by the beneficiary. Because our communities, they tend to occupy the house for 10 years and they don't do maintenance of the house. You can't have a house and then you don't maintain it. Even if it costs you 10 million, you will still have to maintain it. If you could just cover that, I'll be comfortable. And thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Before you respond, maybe one area that for me was of interest, when I don't know if members remember, when we were in Eastern Cape, we encountered a situation where people, because they were waiting for ratification to be done and they couldn't wait, so they did their own ratification of their own houses. But now they were demanding that the government must reimburse them. Now for me, in when you are doing this policy, are you going to classify those kind of people under self-help? Or how are you going to deal with that? Because now you would have people that are not going to wait for government to come and do the remedial or the ratification. They would do it themselves. Then how do we deal with that? And maybe that's for to remind all of us. And I always seem to remember that it's very clear, the policy used to be very clear, that to say from the HSDG, you can only use 5% or less on ratification. And I wanted to be clear that this policy is it going to be very vocal on that, so that we don't just leave it and assume That is something that everybody knows. And then tomorrow, somebody else decides to use more than that in terms of this decision. That's why I have to have those clarities in terms of this policy as it is being formulated. Thanks very much.
We're going to ask the CEO to start and later email them myself and pick up all those other questions.
Thank you, Chair and members. Let me start with Mr. Tolle. The list was not exhaustive. When we finalize the policy, we'll give you a full list in terms of province by province. Because as an NHGRC, we have been contracted by the provinces to do the forensic assessment. So currently, we are working with KZN, and we've got quite a number of projects that are being assessing, and also in the Eastern Cape. Those are the two major projects, I mean, the provinces that we're working on. The numbers are quite big, mm-hmm. but we've done quite a result of the assessment now, which we're going to do. But when we finalize the policy, we'll give you a full assessment of all the houses, how they are actually affected, what's the budget, and everything. But that way, is currently underway. The issues about blacklisting members, yes, we are currently looking into that with Treasury. We would notice, therefore, that starting from this current financial year, as NHGRC, we have started by the judicial processes of all the contractors, whereby they've been found to be in violation of the Code of Conduct. And what we are doing on a quarterly basis, we have a register that we send to the provinces, which indicates which company that has been actually cited. Remember, in terms of our act, we've got to exhaust the process. We kind of blacklist you. We've got to go by our disciplinary processes, which is independent of NHGRC. We've got to have a hearing, a fair hearing, to present yourself. But if you've been found to be in violation of the Code of Conduct or the Norms of Standards, we will therefore suspend your membership as NHGRC. Once you're suspended, you mean you can't do business within the sector as a host. Therefore, that information will be sent to the provinces, and therefore, it's sent to the country and where, therefore, the company will be blacklisted in terms of the process that is followed. So, we've got to follow the law, Chair. But nobody can actually go and take us to court that we were not given a fair hearing and the process was flawed. So that's what we're following in terms of the NHGRC Act. The issue about the budget, of how much has been spent, I think we can come back to the committee because we look at each and every province. But as I've said now, the larger concentration is two provinces, KZN and also the Eastern Cape. In terms of the Northern Cape, we are busy doing assessments. We've got about 12,000 units that have to be assessed in the Northern Cape. They also include the fourth issue. We have been asked by the department and the minister in particular to look into the Northern Cape because that matter has to be addressed. Mm. So currently we've got our service providers busy doing the assessment in the Northern Cape. We've already done about almost 600 houses in terms of assessments. We'll therefore come up with a report in terms of what are the issues with those houses and therefore how much it's going to cost to actually deal with those houses. In terms of the beneficiaries, I'm sure that I will talk more, but we're looking more on making sure that the policy is clear on who must benefit from this policy and how that is going to be actually implemented. If you remember quite well, members, is that what we're looking into is also houses that are not covered by NHGRC between when the PHP and rental housing projects are not actually supposed to be covered in terms of the warranty scheme. What we are saying is for now that starting from 2011, those houses have to be covered. Therefore, this is that assessment also. If you go to, for instance, in Burule, quite a number of projects with PHP, and now they have to be converted, and they're supposed to be enrolled. So this is that assessment in Burule to make sure that those houses will therefore be enrolled with the NHGRC. So we have to do that work. But in the main, the policy is looking to make sure that all houses across the spectrum are covered now by the NHGRC warrant fund. In terms of the payment of the milestone, you also understand that there has been a directive that if you look at all the payment processes, the five of those, from P1 to P5, that if and every payment milestone, NHGRC might sign off to confirm that indeed work has been done according to the Northern Standard. And that's what we're actually encouraging in all the programs, so that then we are certain that indeed the house going forward is going to be of good quality, but again, the beneficiary will benefit from the housing warranty scheme of NHGRC. For a period of 5 years, you know, the trust effect, 1 year roof, and so forth. So indeed, going forward now, we are actually implementing that in the HOD to make sure that indeed they don't pay until NHGRC has been able to actually sign off that physical milestone. We don't wait for the entire house, but if it's foundation, if it's whole place, if it's the roof and everything, NHGRC must sign off all those critical milestones before the payment is done by the respective municipalities or
the provinces. Members, the figures contained in the presentation are only done for the business plan of 15-16.
Mm.
But as I was saying, before we finalize, we'll give you the comprehensive list. But we're just taking from the business plan of the property.
Okay.
But NH does this for the details of every project across the country. We've got spreadsheets that have been given to the department that outlines in every area what is the problem.
Everybody's town is covered.
And then the first stage, yes, we do have those information. There's a lot of work in the first stage, but also we have the numbers of every town that this can actually be provided. We agree, therefore, that the policy is still at this formulation stage, and therefore a lot of work, consultation that is taking place between ourselves and the various provinces and other stakeholders. The issues around remedial vis-a-vis rectification, that's what the policy is trying to clarify, was in a bit of confusion. And therefore, we want to make sure that indeed, as we go forward, there is no confusion around that matter. We have structural engineers as an HBRC that was deployed to all nine provinces. These are full-time employees of NHGRC. They are now located in the political department. In the main, to assist with planning and also to assist with assessment of the project before they are actually being given over to NHGRC for enrollment. So we have deployed those officials. They are full-time employees of NHGRC to the municipalities, to the province, at no cost to the municipalities. They are our full-time employees. So they are actually working in those areas and assist the department. And of course, you are quite correct. The issue of defects vis-a-vis structural maintenance, that is an issue that also attend to through our housing consumer education processes. Chair, Eastern Cape also will provide you the list in terms of what work we're doing, where we are, and also to examine how far the process is. But Chair, I think the issue of the budget percentage of the HSDG, the minister has been very clear in this manner. That is why the process is coming in now. That since the directive has been issued, all provinces that are doing current rectification, they've got to repackage their project and go to the minister and get a special approval in terms of going forward. The issue that the minister wanted to do was to make sure that there is a coordinated approach now. Provinces can't just spend willy-nilly on this matter. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Did you?
Thanks, I think I'm really happy that you've heard what we are saying in terms of the difference between the remedial and the rectification program. The key aspect is around identifying the timeline to say in 2011 there was a minimum resolution which was basically saying all provinces and municipalities that are doing GHG work, they must ensure that all their contractors are registered with the NHGRC, especially the builders. So you have that period where we are now beginning to accommodate the THP program, where it was work that was not fully covered by the previous program. So that time frame is put specifically to address that gap which was there, so that we won't have a situational analysis that we have done. I think in terms of the information that we've presented, we've just extracted what was readily available on the business plan, but we have also requested provinces to be able to give us additional information in relation to what is exactly happening in the various provinces. Like the CAO has indicated, we will be coming back maybe with a full report which fully indicates the other aspects which where you'll be able to see maybe the relevant areas where you come from. And in terms of the consultation, I think we, part of our first engagement with yourself, we have done a series of other consultations regarding what we presented today. It's like a policy which is staying in a draft form, and I think we're discussing it with the DG in the department, we're saying it is the responsibility of the politicians to shape the policy direction that we are taking as a country. The minister has already given us the directive to say we should not be spending a lot of budget on rectification. We should be ensuring that the contractors, they are held responsible. So part of what we are doing today is just to get input from yourself so that when we are taking the final policy proposal, at least it has your input as well and we've accommodated them. In terms of the beneficiaries for the vulnerable groups, I think it's based on our latest engagement regarding what we say should be defined as vulnerable groups. We have decided to include the pregnant women in the sense that they are hazardous aspects when you're talking about a particular property. We are going to probably come back to you and give you the different specifications
yeah.
to say what are we talking about, which will make these other categories people to be more vulnerable. But the issue is we are trying to protect or prevent certain things from happening and not creating other national disasters which will later say we are rectifying. I think the last part is on the issue of the self-help. To say yes, you have those whom I think when you talk about hazards and also dealing with unfortunate events on disasters, you'll identify that there are people who are able to afford to be able to rectify for themselves. We are of the view of the department that those should not be reinvested because it shows that you are able to afford to do changes on your own unit without government being involved. Our key issues around being able to change the mindset of our beneficiaries to be not too much dependent on what government is doing, but to build a society which is more resilient in terms of ensuring that they are able to take themselves out of particular circumstances. And lastly, Chair, just an apology. I think probably when we were circulating the presentation, we did not give a word version of the document. It's available so that you can be able to even give specific comments around some of the areas that you see as skeletons. But we welcome all the input that has been given. We will be able to interrogate and then craft a better solution which will take us out of the current situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Putele. Acting Vision, your last word? You die. Thank you so much. This is not the end of this interaction with us on this issue. We will come back as the policy moves forward. That takes us to the end of the part where we need the department into this accommodation. We want to apologize. I see everybody is really looking for air. Unfortunately, the air is limited in this space. We're done now. Thank you so much, and we really want to appreciate the fact that you've all come in your number, because we needed you, and we will always be needing you, and you must always come in your number. That's now Acting DG is finished. We just left with one item, honorable members, which is just to approve the minutes of the last meeting, and then we will be done. Otherwise, the officials can ask those that want to go out can do so quietly. Those that want to sit until the last item is done can also do so without disturbing us. That's the honorable that are still at work. The honorable members are still at work, so do so quietly. The last item is the minutes of the last meeting, honorable members. I'm just looking at 10 so that you can be excused early. Honorable Tole, the minute. Honorable Tole, can you just approve the minutes or not? Out of order. I'm not going to adopt them. I'm just carrying. Thank you so much, Honorable Mimizi. Seconding, any other person? Okay. Thank you so much. We apologize for the venue, honorable members. Unfortunately, the venue is allocated by the support, that support committee. So this is the venue they gave us. We know that it has not been the best. We will just communicate with them that next week they try and give us a better venue in terms of effort. But otherwise, on that note, the meeting is adjourned. We will see you next Tuesday. Next Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah, we will try our best not to be here. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Mr. Paula, my husband is a hot with the hot with the